Hamthorne hosts.
We're going to go ahead and get started.
Probably.
We've got enough for a quorum and a little more now, so. I'd like to welcome all out to the Northern Regional Advisory Council meeting tonight. My name's Robert Burns, and I'm the chairman. If you'd go ahead and join me in turning your cell phones off or putting them on vibrate, we can get through an uninterrupted meeting. Our purpose here tonight is to hear broad public input on the agenda items and make recommendations to the Wildlife Board concerning wildlife management policy and rules and regulations. We probably won't have any real contentious issues tonight, but please respect other people's opinions. When speaking, please come up to the microphone. We have one here in the center. State your name and where you're from. And we do record our minutes for the, or we do record our meeting. And we'll, that recording is on the web, and our minutes are transcribed mostly from that recording. So it does help the transcriptionist if you do speak into the microphone clearly. Our standard procedure is we'll have a presentation, generally from the Division of Wildlife Resources. We'll have questions from the public. Then we'll have questions from the RAC. Then we'll have comments from the public. If you wish to comment, please fill out a blue card. They're available in the back of the room. Helps us make sure we get your name right and have your information for the minutes. After the comments from the... and when we're taking comments from the public, if you're representing yourself, we'll give you 3 minutes. If you're representing a group, we'll give you 5 minutes. After comments from the public, we'll have comments from the RAC and motions, deliberations on those, and we'll vote. If we can go ahead and have introductions. Jim, why don't you start?
I'm Jim Gaskill from South Weber, Utah. I'm representing at-large.
Craig Van Tassel from Camas, and I'm sportsman rep.
John Blazard from Camas. I represent agriculture.
John Wall from Riverdale. Represent public at large.
I'm Joel Ferry. I live in Fruit Heights, and I represent agriculture.
My name is Bruce Silito. I represent the Bureau of Land Management out of the Salt Lake Field Office, which, of course, oversees BLM lands in Box Elder County, Tooele.
I'm Russ Lawrence. I'm from Ogden, representing public at large.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry, Utah, at large.
And Neville in Farmington, non-consumptive.
And again, I'm Robert Burns, representing the public at large. I live in Centerville.
And I'm Justin Doling, the regional supervisor. I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member of the council.
I'm John Cabot. I represent non-consumptive.
We have several additional members that are excused tonight. Paul Kelly from the Forest Service. Lynn Nielsen representing elected officials. Who else am I missing?
John Leonard.
John Leonard representing sportsmen. And Jeffrey Hicks representing sportsmen. With that, I'd like to recognize Ernie Perkins, represents the Northern Region on the Wildlife Board, sitting in the front row there, and Alan Clark, our assistant director, I got to get that right, in the back, hopefully here to answer some questions if someone has some tonight. So. I think you all received the amended agenda from Stacy via email. And I sent you out the minutes for April 18th meeting. So any changes to the agenda for tonight? Seeing none, do we have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
I have a motion from John Blazard and a second from Craig Van Tassel. All in favor, please say aye. Raise your hands.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Okay. Any amendments to the minutes for April 18th, 2012? Seeing none, do we have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
I'll second.
We have a motion from Ann DeVille and a second from Russ Lawrence to approve the minutes of April 18th, 2012. All in favor, say aye. Raise your hands.
Aye.
Any opposed? Are you going to abstain, John, because you weren't present? Okay. So let me get your hands in favor again, please.
I wasn't present either.
One, two, three. 8 in favor, 2 abstain because they weren't present. Oh. Okay. On the Wildlife Board meeting update, I emailed you their summary of motions. Were there any questions, additional questions on the Wildlife Board's actions? Seeing none, we'll go to the regional update with Justin Dole.
Okay, I just got a brief regional update this evening, and I want to start out with a couple of announcements. May 31st, our big game drawing results will be posted on our website. So I encourage you to go to our website on May 31st and see if you drew a big game hunting permit. Our antlerless application period will start June 1st and run through the 21st of June. So if you're interested in trying to pursue an antlerless animal, I'd encourage you to go on there and apply for the antlerless application. And on to just a couple topics here in the region. Our law enforcement people report that we've had several boats that have been infested with quagga mussels that they've successfully detained and decontaminated. So that's good news. We've improved some of our patrol efforts at the borders, and that's where some of these things are being detected. Others are boats that are being bought and sold and transported, and we get notified of that. So that's good news. Starting this year, we're going to do these little mini range assessments, and I think Darren sent out an email inviting all the RAC members to come out and participate in that. So I'd encourage you to do so. It's a way to kind of assess the condition of the range, look at utilization over the winter, look at pellet group counts for mule deer and elk, and just kind of a way to get a feel for how our range is going. So if you've got time, I would encourage you to spend some time out in the field with our biologists. I do want to announce that the 2012 Federal Duck Stamp Contest will be held here at Weber State, September 28th and 29th. And that's a national contest, and it will be for the 2013-14 waterfowl hunting season. And that program is essentially a federal program that requires all waterfowl hunters to purchase a duck stamp when they're over the age of 16. So if you want to spread that word, it's a pretty prestigious event, and there's a lot of good artwork that will be on display as the judges are looking things over. Also, on another note, our law enforcement section conducted an antler auction / fur auction, and that effort earned our agency about $104,000. Mm-hmm. So it was extremely successful. That money goes back into our division's general account, but it was extremely successful. And last but not least, I want to let you know where the fishing's really hot, because I know you guys all like to fish. So right now, Willard is fishing really well. East Canyon, Rockport,
and also Hiram. So get your poles out and head up to the reservoirs. Thanks.
Thank you, Justin. When did Darren send that email out?
Yeah, Darren sent that email out, I believe, the middle of last week. Did everybody receive that?
Yeah. I need to pay better attention. If I haven't received it, I'll contact you. Given that, we'll go ahead and move on to item number 6, collection, importation, and possession rule, number 5, conservation permit rule and amendments, and Greg Sheehan will be presenting that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and council members. My name is Greg Sheehan. I'm from Administrative Services Group in the Salt Lake office, and I'll be presenting this tonight. Kevin Bunnell has been doing these throughout the state and wasn't able to be here tonight, so I'll be presenting this, and then a little later on I'll be presenting a variance rule for your consideration. As we go through this, there, many of you on the council here were emailed some thoughts or comments about this conservation permit rule in the last few days. And so hopefully, and now, especially after last night's RAC, we were able to kind of air those a little bit. And I'm going to help try to explain some of what that confusion was or controversy, if you will, or mild controversy. So I think we'll be able to move through this fairly easily tonight with those explanations. If we do have some questions that I'm not able to answer, we've got Alan Clark here, so he's just going to help out with that. So anyway, this is the conservation permit rule update, which we have to bring out periodically. It's rule R657-41. A real quick program history on that. This program began back in 1981 with a desert bighorn sheep that was sold by the division. And then that expanded to a maximum of one permit per species up until 1994. In about 1997, there was quite a bit of growth in the permits and the revenue that brings into the division. During the initial period, clear through 1998, we generated about $1.3 million. And I won't read all these, but in the last 2 years, it's generated about $5.3 million. And in total, since the inception, we're about $25 million of revenue that's come in to help manage wildlife throughout the state and do some really great things with transplants or reintroductions and research, those types of things. This rule has been modified many times, and as we've learned and things have grown, I'll quickly identify some of those changes. In 1999, there was a cap put on area permits at 8. A formula for past performance was added to help make it clear who should be getting these permits. Recipients were allowed to designate another person if they were able to draw a permit in a regular draw, so they didn't have two permits in 1 year. In 2000, the rule change there allowed some of the money that was used for a particular species to be used for another species if the DWR and the group agreed. We added turkey, cougar, and bear statewide back then. 2002, one application per conservation organization was put into place. At that time, there was a little bit of confusion of who the official representative of some of these groups were, so that was fixed and as we move forward. We clarified that the board can select a recipient other than the high bidder after considering some other criteria that are in the rule. There were criteria limiting the growth of the program was added. The board could authorize a second statewide conservation for a special event or purpose. 2003, 90% of the funds raised must be used on projects that benefit the conservation permit species, so that was clarified. We began an auditing and accounting procedure back then so that we'd perform audits on this annually. Project reporting approval procedures were added. 2006, we defined conservation permit species, deer, elk, pronghorn, moose, bison, bighorn, sheep, turkey, bear, and cougar. Instituted multi-year conservation permit program. Allowed 10% of the bighorn sheep permits as conservation permits. 2007 added that a person identified in the conservation permit voucher must have a current Utah hunting or combination license to redeem the voucher. And that was a program that we instituted statewide, requiring hunting licenses. In 2010 was the addition of a couple of permits for Antelope Island, or known as Special Antelope Island permits, for a deer and a bighorn sheep. And the revenue generated from those goes to Division of Parks and Recreation. Last year there was an audit done. It addressed this audit several things in Division. It looked at our fish hatcheries, it looked at our habitat program, and it looked at conservation permit program. It was limited in scope, but one of the comments that they had at the end, it said the sale conservation permits promotes habitat improvements on public lands with no expense to the taxpayer, while negligibly reducing the public's opportunity to draw a permit for a limited entry hunting area. We would encourage the division to continue to support this program. So that was one of their findings in this particular area of the audit. Some of the accomplishments, habitat projects in the last 6 years, has been 309 different habitat projects that these funds have been used towards. In the last 12 years, there's been bighorn sheep transplants. 561 bighorn sheep were moved throughout the state, or into the state in many cases. Multiple pronghorn transplants, about 350 were moved. Bison were moved from the Henry Mountains to the Book Cliffs. A lot of research, most of which is still ongoing. Highway mortality study along Highway 6 and others. Effects of predators on mule deer. That's a new study, the Monroe Mountain study, which is really just getting started last several years using these funds. Mule deer, doe, and fawn survival statewide, that's ongoing. That's helping provide some good information, or we'll soon do that. And moose survival, there's been some struggles with some of the moose populations, and this is one new one that was just funded to do some research on what's affecting some of our moose populations. So what are the rule changes we've got today? First one, allow turkey conservation permit holders to hunt statewide during the general season, or the over-the-counter turkey hunt. So right now, an individual can go buy an over-the-counter turkey permit and hunt statewide with that, but our conservation permit holders are limited to only hunting in one part of the state. So we're just trying to create that parity where they can go hunt around the state, just like anyone who buys an over-the-counter permit. Second thing, define that the potential number of multi-year conservation permits is calculated based on number of public permits issued in the prior year. So we're basically saying we've got to have a baseline for multi-year permits. And then the next one, and it's really the one that created the most confusion out in the public, and it was really intended to simplify things. So I'll explain it a little bit, but we've put actual tables into the rule that talk about on the multi-year permits and the number of public permits. So, for example, if there's 11 to 30 public permits for a hunt, there'd be one conservation permit. Where the confusion came in is in the past rule, and even a little bit of the current rule, it talks about percentages. It says there can be no more than 5% or no more than 10% of bighorn sheep. And so I think a lot of the confusion is that we've laid out a table here that talks about a range of permits. Again, the 11 to 30 is one. And then if you in the same rule, you see, well, 5% doesn't really look like one tag for 11, but it's less than 5 for 30. So what we're really trying to do is move away from people having to constantly look at these percentages to figure out how many permits we're going to issue in any given year. You know, percentages work great on high numbers, but when we're talking about 6 or 8 permits on a sheep area and you start talking about 5 or 10% of the permits, you quickly get into fractions and you quickly get into rounding. And that's what created a lot of confusion to the public. So what we're hoping to do here is just say, here's a table. If anybody ever wants to know, you can see how many permits are that year and you'll be able to see how many conservation permits we're going to issue. Include an option, a mechanism for reducing the number of conservation permits for once in a lifetime if the number of public permits declines during the time period for which multi-year permits were awarded. So basically we're saying, okay, conservation organizations, here's what we're doing, you know, in a multi-year permit thing, but if for some reason we start to see a drop-off or decline, we may need to come back to you and reduce those permits to be in line with what we're having to do with the public permits. Change the timing when funds are transferred to the division from conservation organizations for projects for which they've committed funding. Currently, we invoice the organizations and say, for the money for a project as soon as it's done. And this rule change would request the money as soon as the project's approved or within 90 days of approving it. And that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Do we have any questions from the public on Greg's presentation? Yes, come up, sir.
My name is Michael Christensen. You guys all probably received some emails from me, and I guess I'm the one that's confused, probably one of the troublemakers that have been causing this. So a couple questions. Why are you striking the words a map? Currently in the rule, it says a maximum of 5% or a maximum of 10%. Why are you striking those words?
The reason is because this table will lay out the permit numbers. And I think, honestly, what we probably should have done in this rule, and we may go back now after all this discussion and change it, is get rid of that 5% and 10%, not just a maximum of 5 or a maximum of 10. And basically just say, here's the table for the permit numbers. So if we want to have a dialogue about how many permits ought to be out there, let's just look at the table. And if it seems high or low, that's something we can always adjust over time. But we've got two things that are conflicting in this rule, and I think you caught on to those, Mike, is how do you say 5%? Of a range. It doesn't work. 5% works at some point in the range. You're either below it or above it. And that's been some confusion in years past, and I think you identified that, and we had some good conversation last night. So I think if we can stick to the tables, if people have a problem with the tables, numbers, that's worth adjusting. But we're swinging back and forth. Is this 5 or 10%, or is it this table thing? Error on our part. That's what I'd say.
Okay. In past RACs, the division's proposal has stated that this is no increase in conservation permits. And then in the central RAC and in the southeastern RAC, they stated that they've been over-issuing permits under this rule. Can you address that?
Yeah, and it's right back to that 5% thing again. It works great if you got 50 permits on a Pavant elk unit, easy. Really hard when we're back down to the 6 permits on a sheep unit. And so what's happened in some cases is they've had this language in there that said it can be no more than 10%. And if you had 6 permits, 10% is 0.6. So they were going ahead and rounding and creating a permit. So it wasn't more than 10%, absolutely. Not, it wasn't like piles of permits or whatever, but it rounded to create a permit. We need to just kind of forget that whole 5 and 10% thing and use these tables and have that for our discussions, I think.
Okay, so where in the rule does it say that they could have used rounding to over-issue tags?
It doesn't.
So
it doesn't say
so they wrong. So the division was incorrect in using rounding to go over the maximum of 5%. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah, I think that's, but I don't think it was like widespread permits flying all over the place.
No.
In some cases where it rounded to get to a permit, it happened. No doubt about it.
And so it was 20 to 30 permits is all.
Well, not in those maybe once in a lifetime species it wouldn't have been, because we don't even really have that many out there. So
no, just overall.
Yeah,
for overall.
It might have been. That's why, again, we need to fix this. So you're exactly right.
So you're addressing another question that I had is that you keep saying that this rule is to the change of the rule is for clarity issues.
Uh-huh.
But when you have the table, if you went back to that, I just want to understand this so we can... The table shows one of 11 is 9+%. Mm-hmm. So if a unit has 11 permits, it will qualify one under this change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if a sheep unit has 5 permits, it will qualify under this change for one tag, correct?
Let me read you what the table is. I don't have that screen up here, but everybody out here. 5 to 14 would qualify as one on sheep.
Okay, yeah. So
it's more than 10% on
it's
that.
It's 20.
But if a unit has 14 tags and you only give one, yeah. then it's only 7% or something if someone did the math. So it kind of just depends on that year on how many permits are in a unit. And if you're somewhere between the 5 and the 14, anywhere in that range qualifies for one. So somewhere right in the middle, if there were 10 permits on that unit, which is a possibility, there'd be one permit and it would be 10. So anything below 10, yeah, it'd be more than 10%. Anything above 10, be less than 10%.
So this change, this proposed change, can increase permits of the possible permits that don't reach the 20 on the other species. So if a unit has 18 tags under the current rule, that's zero conservation permits.
And are you talking on sheep or on
other species?
Okay.
Because I think sheep, we'll talk about that in the discussion later, but because I think the central rack had a pretty good, but I just want to understand that if a unit has 11 permits under the current rule, how many permits would it qualify for?
I think it would still be one. I'm going to let Alan do that because he's always been the guy who's done the math on these. So.
Yeah. Let me give some history. This rule has changed almost every year since 1998. And actually, and I went back and researched the whole history just so we would know exactly what was done. The old rule said 5%, just mm-hmm. like now, and then it also had a table. And the table said if there's 2 to 14 permits, then there's one conservation permit. How do you merge those?
Yeah.
And I'm talking about, that's 1999, okay? So over the course of time, we've been trying to adjust this to make it more or less contradictory to what it is. And the last change we made, which is the maximum of 5%, prior to 1996, it said a maximum of 5%, except the Wildlife Board could issue a higher number. So we still had maximum 5%, but the Wildlife Board was allowed to exceed that. And when we tightened it up in 1996, we eliminated that board discretion in that section of the rule, but we never had interpreted the maximum 5% the same way that you're interpreting it now.
Yeah.
When so I the language might have been wrong, because I've calculated the permits every year since 1999, and I'll tell you it's exactly the same way now as it was then. We tried to put language in that matched how we were calculating it, mm-hmm. and obviously we made a mistake. Now, you can say we violated the rule if you want to say it that way. The other thing you can say is we didn't write the rule very clear to do that, because there actually still is a section in the rule that says the number of conservation and sportsman's permits available for use during the following year are determined by the Wildlife Board annually. So it already gives the Wildlife Board authority to do something else, even in the current rule. So it's pretty hard. We're trying, Mike, we're trying to tighten it down. It was my idea to put this table in here. I actually have the table from 2009, if anybody wants to see, and this actually would give a couple less permits than the table I used in 2009. So we've been trying to tighten it down. It can be portrayed as violating our rule. I'll tell you, being the person who most used the rule and wrote a lot of the language, it was never what we were trying to do is write the rule to reflect how we were doing it, not the other way around.
Yeah, and just to clarify that, I'm not trying to attack anybody or claim that anybody did anything willingly. I think it was just an oversight.
I absolutely agree. I think putting the word maximum in where we put it, yep, and taking out the other language was an oversight, and we shouldn't have done it. The number of permits issued are exactly the same as been done until you get back to 1999. Then there were a whole lot more issued. And actually we've made a couple changes to give a lot less over time. We've actually reduced the number of permits by, I think, 70 or so, and you probably know the number. You and I have talked about this, yeah, but probably by 70 permits since the peak year in 2005, I think, was the highest number ever. So we have tried to reel the program in, and that's the only reason we did this, is to reflect past practice very clearly so nobody can misinterpret it. So,
do you feel that how this public process is going, that the rule that you're presenting is clear enough that won't?
No, I think that what Greg suggested, the thing we talked about, we probably need to take the 5% out and not even have it in there. What we did is we said it's 5% and then said how we calculate 5%. But, you know, and we have a similar problem, just so you know, we have a very similar problem with non-resident
I understand.
Tags. And the Wildlife Board issued an edict that 10%, no more than 10% of the tags can go to non-residents. Yet we also, since they did that, have rounded, and the Wildlife Board passes it, and we even pointed out to the Wildlife Board, you know, we're rounding, maybe you want to raise that percent. And the Wildlife Board said, no, that's good enough. You know, and so I, like I said, I have a lot of history, and I just wanted to make it clear how we got to where we got. Now, what number you want to use, as Greg said, that's a call, that's a policy issue, and if somebody says this number's in the table are wrong and we want to use a different set of numbers, that's for the public to comment on, but I just want to clarify the history, is all.
Yeah, that, now you're talking. Hey, thanks for your time.
Yeah.
Any additional questions? Yes, sir.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. Greg, you were down at the RAC meeting last night. Carl Hurst passed out a similar table based upon permit numbers and what they'd equal. How does that compare to what we're looking at right here? Have you had a chance
to... Holy cow, I wish I'd have put it side by side. I think it was very similar. I bet Mike knows because he probably has done the comparison. Now, I don't think it's way off. Where it got a little bit trickier is in those sheep permits and the 10%. And I think that's what the RAC last night struggled, and they kind of ended up with accepting the table that was handed out and then keeping for all the other the so non-sheep species, and they'd left the
excluding
sheep.
Excluding the Mike, sheep maybe. And just pertaining to the other once-in-a-lifetime deer and elk, and that the table's fairly close, or is it...
Mike Christensen again. The table follows the maximum of 5%, which means for every 20 permits, they can issue one conservation tag for all other species, not talking about sheep. So the range is 20 to 39, because that meets the current rule, which the current rule states a maximum of 5%. So it can't be 5.1%. It has to be a maximum of 5%, because that's what the rule reads. So it would be 20 to 39, 40 to 59, 60 to 79, 80 to 99, and so on until it reaches 160. And then 160 over, that's just 8 permits. That's when it reaches the maximum.
Now, Carl was also saying that sometimes it erred and it gave away not enough. Is that true in that particular?
It erred and gave away not enough. What do you mean?
I mean, based upon percentages, that the percentages drop below the 5% or the 10%?
Well, since the current rule reads a maximum of 5%, that means that it can't go over 5%, but it can go under. And so you'll go over 5% if you issue a permit before it reaches an extra permit before it reaches that number divided by 20. So. If you have 59 permits, you can only issue 2 conservation permits under the maximum of 5% rule, but you're probably bumping right down to, you know, probably what's that, 2% or so of that, or just a little bit under 4%. So it puts, the current rule has a ceiling in it that you can't go above 5%. And so that's what that table, which is a great idea, whatever numbers you want to use, mm-hmm. That's why that goes from 20 to 39 and so on in increments.
And also, Greg, I mean, who decides the number of permits and what permits are going to be available in the conservation permit program?
Hey, Alan, you can holler from back there.
Jody would yell at me. Right?
Yep.
What we've done is used that table I told you I have in the back room. If anybody wants to see it, they can see it. I brought it along. It's actually written in my writing, so you can see it. But what we do is just apply that to the number of permits being issued in that year. So we use a base year, and that's what we determine. And then actually the Wildlife Board has to approve them. We make a recommendation, and the Wildlife Board approves them. You know, and again, if we want to start arguing, is it in compliance with the rule or not, I'd argue that language that I read to you that's currently in the rule that says the Wildlife Board can do what they want to do makes that not a violation of the rule. So I'm just saying, but it's different than the 5%. I absolutely agree with Mike that it's different than the 5% because we were using rounding. But so this year, my great hope is for the first time in 12 years, I won't have anything to do with the conservation permit program. And actually, Kevin Bunnell will, working with Anise, will calculate the permits. I'm starting to lose a little hope.
You're losing some hair too, man.
Yeah.
I am. One more point, though. So once you designate the permits that are eligible and it gets passed by the Wildlife Board, then the conservation groups have the ability to bid and secure the permits they have, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it's a very detailed process that we came up in 2006, and I think all of the groups will say it works way better than anything we've had in the past. It also has both 3-year permits and 1-year permits. And the 1-year permits provide some opportunity for new groups to come in that maybe have never had one. So
until the Wildlife Board approves those, conservation groups don't come in and tell you, hey, Alan, we want these permits. You need to set them aside.
No.
All right. Thank you.
Any additional questions from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on the topic? Go ahead, John.
According to this paperwork, it says that for every conservation permit that is issued, there's also a sportsman permit put into a draw for anyone.
It's actually a statewide.
Yes.
It's a sportsman's permit for every statewide conservation permit.
So if there's eight sheep permits issued, there's also 8 sportsmen?
No.
There's only one per species, unless we had a special deal, and that's only been used once, and that's when we hosted a national convention of one group, and I can't even remember who it was. It's Pope and Young.
John.
He issued an extra statewide bison permit, but that's the only, I think it was bison, right? I think it was bison. We issued it's the only time we've ever issued 2 statewide conservation permits for any species was that 1 year, and it triggered that thing, so. But there's one and one. So if you look at the statewide permits, there's one statewide permit for bighorn sheep and one sportsman's permit that anybody can apply for that has exactly the same seasons.
Alan, yes. I think John's confusion is the
word statewide.
The statewide in the area.
Okay.
Okay, so there's one sportsman's permit for the statewide. And then there are also area conservation permits.
And then area conservation permits are limited to be lesser.
To a certain boundary.
Yeah.
Smaller unit.
But there, it's still a one per one for conservation versus sportsman.
For statewide, yeah.
Just for statewide.
Yes.
Okay.
Because it doesn't make sense for area because all the rest of them go to the public for the area one. So okay. We just, when the rule was first established, that was kind of, if we're going to use one of these permits as a special fundraiser, let's make one available to anybody that doesn't have the money to bid a lot in an auction. So that's kind of the history of what led to that.
Okay. Joel.
I've just got a quick question. If this rule has been changed every year, year after year after year, is this going to fix that? I'm just wondering why. I mean, Why has this been such a difficult process?
I think it's been pretty stable since 2006, if you remember the table. The last time it was changed was when we added the Antelope Island hunts.
Okay, a couple of years ago. I remember that.
So it's actually been pretty stable since we got into the rotation that we're in. So.
Okay, so is this is to clarify and hopefully provide some certainty to the...
Yes. I hope I'm retired before the next time that this rule is amended.
All right. I just hate to reinvent the wheel every year, so.
I got a question.
Go ahead.
So would it be a lot easier if we struck a maximum 5% clear over and just, I mean, is that what everybody else is saying? That just,
just went to strictly the model only and get rid of the number totally?
Yeah, I think that would be a good way for this rack to do it. No rack has, the rack last night adopted a table, right? But they didn't strike the other language, or did they strike the other language?
They maintained the other language and maintained the table.
Right. So I think this rack, if they want to, I believe the division will probably recommend that we strike those, but it would be good if this rack, for whatever you want to do, and like I said, I'm not arguing that it has to be those numbers. I'm arguing that that table reflects history, and that if you pass the table, I think that's the best way to do it, so there's never a question about how many permits will be available. So. Does that answer what you...
Yeah, I was just seeing if that's kind of what everybody... You know, would feel that would just get rid of that. People keep thinking about the 5% and they just lose focus on the table. Now, if we just had a table and throw out the number, they would just simplify it.
Yep.
Okay, but it'll always fall in that realm for them. So,
any additional questions? Jim Gaskin.
If we just deleted that whole sentence, including the 8 permit part, is that going to hurt anything? I mean, already 8's a maximum, so. Well, that whole B and small a sections, those two sentences could go and everybody would be happy.
Yeah, probably you just need to say for the remaining conservation permits, this is the table, and you know, you probably need a little bit of that sentence to lead in so you know what you're talking about, but you're right, you don't need much of it, just enough to say the top one's bighorn sheep and the bottom one's everything else, and that would resolve it.
Okay.
I can give you a little guidance when we get to comments. I can give you my take on it when we get to comments. So, any additional questions? Seeing none, we'll go ahead to the public comments, and we did have one blue card, didn't we? Judy. Mike, come on up.
My name is Michael Christensen. I appreciate the time that you guys are allowing me to explain this proposal. I want to start off by saying that in no way am I here to hurt the conservation permit program. And in no way is what I say against any group. This is just about the change that you guys are going to make over what the current rule is. No matter how it's been allocated in the past, the current rule is being changed. I served on the Habitat Council for 4 years. I see where the monies go. It's a great program. The thing that I ask you to do tonight is to vote for a table for all species except for sheep that includes 20 to 39 that gives a true maximum of 5% in the conservation tag permits to those species. The sheep, I'm going to defer to those behind me because the sheep is maybe a little bit different. You know, we don't have very many tags. It's a it's an expensive program to run. Maybe they need an extra tag or two. I don't know. I'll leave that up to you guys. But on the other species, I think we need to maintain that maximum of 5%. One of the biggest divisive issues in hunting right now, besides all the deer stuff we've gone through, is the conservation permit program. We're selling our tags to the rich. The rich don't have to wait in line. I mean, we hear that all the time. I mean, and if you don't, you haven't served on the rack very long, probably, because when they went through and put that maximum of 5% wording in, it was a struggle. I mean, there was so much divisive tension about people, you know, seeing the public resource sold off. So I think that would alleviate that to include a table, but to go with the 5% maximum. Really quickly, it's it'll cost maybe 20 total tags out of the current program. You're only going to lose 20 tags, maybe 25, depending on what the permits and how you know each thing lays out. And I just want to state publicly that we've got 30 micro unit deer or 30 micro deer units now, which qualify under this program at 8 permits a pop. That could be an extra 240 tags. And I don't know if this rack wants to take this up because no other rack has. It hasn't been mentioned yet. But maybe there should be a cap on those general deer tags and use those as a regional, give those on a regional basis, somewhat like they do or have done the turkey permits. And that's just one thing that's been expressed to me over time. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Troy Justinson.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. SFW has no interest whatsoever in changing the rule or the mechanism to increase conservation permits. Our hope is that through the table that's been put here and the table that was submitted in the central region, that the division can come back and along the lines of what Michael said, come up with a formula that holds it at that 5%. We do ask that in the sheep it be looked at differently. As we talked about in the meeting last night, the conservation permit money is the lifeblood to Utah's sheep program. We've been recognized nationally as having one of the best sheep programs in the U.S. Bottom line, we're hunting the number of sheep in the state of Utah that we are today solely because of the conservation permit program. We would ask that somehow, some way we go in and whatever we adjust the percentage or the table, that at least we can maintain the number of sheep tags we have at this point. It's worth it. You know, someday I want to hunt one. I can't afford to buy those. And if we keep this money in there, sheep are expensive. There's no cheap thing about them. And if we can keep this pool in there, keep growing our sheep herd, it benefits all. We appreciate what you guys do. We hope you kick it over. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Ryan Fouts.
Ryan Fouts with the Utah Finaz. First, let me just say thanks to Alan Clark for all your hard work over the years for putting the conservation permit program together and the permits that are issued to each conservation group. I want to specifically talk about Utah Finaz. I'll echo somewhat what Troy said. Sheep are an expensive species to manage. Does that mean that there should be some unfair advantage to having more conservation permits than maybe the other? My argument would be yes. I'll give you an example. In the current sheep management plan that I got from Anise a few years ago, because we're on a five-year management plan in there, it stated that back in 1989, we currently had an estimated population in the state of Utah of between 700 and 800 wild sheep. I'm not sure if any of you know, but do you know how many currently are our population of bighorn sheep is in the state of Utah currently, right now? It's over 5,000. That is absolutely a direct reflection of the money that is raised through the conservation permit program. The conservation permit program, as I talk to people, there is just a ton of misinformation. And when you sit down and talk to people and tell them where this money goes and what it's for and who it's benefiting, it kind of makes sense. There seems to be some jealousy out there that some rich guys can buy 5% of these permits and go hunting every year. What they don't realize is that 95% get to partake of what the work that goes on the ground to increase those numbers. I've asked the Division of Wildlife actually to produce a table for us and told them to put it on their homepage that would show the same graph of the dollars that have been spent since its inception that would follow the dollars being spent with also the opportunity to the public. Another example is that last year there was about 320 conservation permits. This year there's going to be 5,400 limited entry and once in a lifetime permits issued. Okay? 5,400, 300. There's a pretty big difference there of who's getting, and we want the public. The reason we do this is to create more opportunity. That's the sole reason. I happen to be sitting on 18 bonus points for Desert Bighorn Sheep. 18 years. I, like Troy, cannot afford to buy one. I'm probably going to draw one of those in the next year or two. Excited as hell. Ooh, strike that. Sorry. You know, but that's what this is all about, to give more opportunity. I would encourage you guys tonight to adopt something. We're not about getting more permits. We are about maintaining the integrity of this program. We want the public to understand it. I applaud Mike and his efforts for what he said tonight, kind of representing the public and what he did last night in the Central Rack. I have faith that you guys will do the right thing in the Wildlife Board to maintain the integrity of this program. Thank you.
So, yes. Ryan, your recommendation is to maintain the current permit numbers?
Yeah, let me clarify. My recommendation is to maintain the conservation permit program, the recommended rule changes, but let's go with something that is clear and doesn't conflict with each other. And right now, it looks to me like 5% in the table are conflicting. And what people are having heartburn with is that conflicting, and that, I guess, that would be. So let's get clear. On sheep, it's obviously 10%. Yeah, I'm asking for a little wiggle room because, you know, there's not many of them. If we have to go by that, we're not going to have any tags to sell. I'll just be candid. I mean, it doesn't work.
Okay.
It doesn't work.
I got a question for him. Ryan, will the table for the sheep, will that jive with what the sheep
to
tags?
To be candid, because I didn't know about taking that off, the percentage off, and using the table, I don't know what that will do. I'd have to have, maybe Alan could clue me in as to what that would actually mean to how many sheep tags. I'd have to go look. So,
can you tell us, Alan, that number, please?
I'm more afraid of her than you.
You got to bring your chair with you.
Well, 10%.
Yeah, he does.
Reduce the number.
The table is intended to exactly duplicate what we've been doing. That's what the table is
intended
to do.
Then I'm totally comfortable with that. Thank you, Alan.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks.
Any additional comments from the public? I do have one email from United Wildlife Cooperative. Their president was unable to attend tonight due to death in the family, so he asked me to read this statement. In regards to the conservation permit allocations, the United Wildlife Cooperative recognizes the good that comes from the funds generated by the conservation permit program. Last fall, it came to our attention that the UDWR and organizations that receive conservation permits were in violation of the rule that governs these permits and that several species were beyond the percentage defined by the governing rules. At April's RAC meetings, we asked that we figure out a way to realign the allocations with the rule. Instead, it seems that we are rewriting the rule to fit the infraction that, and ultimately proposing to increase the relative number of permits. The UWC simply asked that we make the necessary adjustments to stay within the guidelines of 5% or less for all non-sheep conservation permits and 10% for sheep permits. We also asked that triggers be in place that will allow us to adhere to allocation percentages in the case of future permit reductions. It is our experience that Utah sportsmen and women are growing leery of the conservation permit program and that taking the necessary precautions to stay within the current allocation rule will go a long ways towards garnering future support for the program and the ultimate benefit to wildlife that these funds provide. Thank you for your time and consideration. Ty Bolter, President, United Wildlife Cooperative. With that, we have no further public comment. We go to the council. Now, I would just comment that if you're going to strike the percentages, that you would put a reference to the table or that limit of permits. I think it would be a little clearer. So, additional comments from the council. Craig.
I'd like the division to comment on the 30-unit deer.
Certainly.
On the conservation tags that would come out of the 30 units.
The division had no interest in issuing any general season deer tags, and actually we were supposed to take that out, so if this RAC wants to include that in their motion, that's fine. I thought it was out, and I went through and read it, and we said no. I mean, we met with all of the groups, and when we talked about proposed changes, we said we weren't going to issue any general season deer tags because of that. So I thought it was in there, and when you said it, Mike, I thought you missed something, and I found out I missed something. So, but no interest in that because, you know, and we could just, if you want to add a clarifying statement, no general season deer tags, that's fine. We'll fit it in the rule where it belongs.
Additional comments from the RAC? John.
It just seems to me like if we get rid of the percentage, it seems to me like if we can come up with a table which has the parameters like was presented to us that shows that within a certain number it matches the 5% or doesn't exceed it, so that the table shows the number and the number of permits that are available there, that's probably the best, in my opinion, that's the best way to go. That way we don't have to multiply and do all of that stuff. We know exactly how many permits, if we can juggle instead of having 11 30 if we had 11 to 30 if we had I don't remember the number
20 to 40,
if that hits the parameters of the percentages, that's by far the more simple way to go, in my opinion.
So the table that you would be recommending would be more of a rounding down table than a rounding up table?
Yeah, like, is it Mike? Mike presented to us. That way we could eliminate all of the percents and the rounding and all of those things. It would be cut and dried.
Would that table be only for the remainder species or for sheep and
remainder? Well, I think sheep need to be,
separate.
Separate.
Okay.
But I'm in favor of the public getting all the permits that they can.
Additional comments?
Comment.
Yes, Joel.
If we did that, we talked about reducing tags, 20 to 25 tags. What's the financial cost of that? I think that's a consideration in making that kind of decision. What would that cost the division to lose that many tags?
I think it's more the total loss, not just what the division gets.
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell because we don't know what species of permits and all.
Yeah,
let me give you a financial perspective, and hopefully this will help frame it a little bit. If you lost 25 tags out of, say, 300 or 320, whatever, you'd be, say, you'd lose roughly 10% or something. To give you an idea, last year, all of the limited entry permits that we sold through our draws to residents and non-residents for all these species, cougar, bear, elk, sheep, everything, added up to $1.6 million, everything we sold. If you put in a drawing, and not for a general deer tags or whatever, but all the drawing stuff was $1.6 million of revenue. These 320 permits was $2.4 million that came to us. So using that simple math, if we're going to lose roughly, we'll just say 10% of the permits,
about
$240,000. But I don't know if it's really that because, none of us know until we really got
market,
a table
sure.
out and started down.
But that's just a rough estimate of...
Yeah, probably $250,000. And
Mike.
We're not dealing with sheep.
We need to.
If we do that, I really can't tell you for sure what it would be. But
he said we're not dealing with sheep. Just to.
So and it might be a little less than that, without sheep. I honestly don't know, but
okay.
Just to give you kind of the ballparks of what kind of numbers we're talking about.
I mean, it's hard to make a decision like this, not understanding the financial impact it's going to have.
It would honestly vary year by year, too, because
sure.
as things toggle in and out of those ranges, it triggers different things going on. So.
And your funds are all basically habitat funds.
Yeah, mostly habitat. Well, we do some with transplants and some research, but mostly habitat is how these dollars go. So. Yeah.
Additional comments from the council?
I'd like to ask a question.
Certainly.
So in follow-up to the question that was just asked, if you're going to lose a significant amount of money, no matter what that number is, but it is a significant amount of money, what resources would that money be used on if you have it, and what resources wouldn't benefit if you don't have it? In other words, what type of projects?
Well, again, I don't. We generally try to keep the dollars with the species. So if that resulted in cuts in elk permits, which is probably the largest one of these categories we have, we would cut back on elk-related projects, elk habitat projects. We do more habitat really with elk than we do a lot of. We don't really do a lot of transplants and that type of thing with elk. So as you got into other things, you know, deer. We do lately. We're doing a lot more research on deer because of all the deer, you know, challenges around. So we'd probably cut back on some deer research because there's a lot of that going on right now. But it's hard to say for sure. We just have to look and see what the new piles of money. You know, there's a little bit of argument. Well, maybe if you had less, you'd sell them for more, you know. So I don't know. It would be a new world. We'd have, it, you know, to some level, we'd shrink the pot of money. We'd adapt, you know. So I guess the question is, are these permits that much of a hindrance in the public's ability to draw that we want to shrink the pot of money that we're receiving in the division? I guess speaking from the division, we feel like we need all those dollars. You know, there's a lot of real critical issues we're dealing with in wildlife right now. And, man, we hate to see money going away on something. You know, we're not really here with the table proposing to add anything new. So I guess status quo kind of works.
So one follow-up. So if you're spending less on those projects, habitat and research, it's difficult for you to answer this question, I know, but there may be long-term impacts to the species and thus long-term impacts to the public's ability to drop tags?
Yeah, possibly. You know, this money really, when I mentioned the $1.6 million we get from all the limited entry stuff that goes out to the regular public, that's 7,200 permits gets us $1.6 million. That's kind of helping us, you know, the people, some of them here in the room, that's helping sort of pay salaries and keep us going. That $2.4 million gives money for all these folks to go out and do stuff. You know, we don't just want to have people driving around in a truck with nothing to do. That's really the money that gives us a core to help wildlife. So we hate to see that go away.
Any additional comments from the council? Okay. We do have recommendations to limit to the maximum of 5% for the remainder species. We have a recommendation from the public, let's say. We have a recommendation from the public to maintain the current conservation sheep permit numbers. And we also have a recommendation from Alan Clark to include in our motion exempting general season deer conservation permits or not having them part of the rule. Anything I missed? Okay. Are there any of those you want to hit individually, or does someone want to make a motion to?
I think I think we ought to take care of the conservation deer issue by itself, just get it off the, you know,
okay,
done. I think that makes a lot of sense to me. So I'd make a motion that we exclude the general season deer from the conservation permits.
Second.
I'll second that.
We have a motion from Joel Ferry and a second from Bryce Thurgood to exclude the general season deer permits from the conservation permit program.
Yep.
Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll have a vote. All in favor of the motion, please raise your hand and say aye.
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 It's unanimous.
I'd like to make a stab at the other one.
Okay, go ahead, Bryce.
That we, for the conservation,
conservation permits, that first of all, we take the 10% language out for the sheep and go on the table only. And on the rest of the species, we take the 5% language out and go strictly on the table as stated on both tables.
As presented.
As presented, sorry.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by John Wall. Discussion on the motion. Jim.
You want to leave the 8 permit number in that?
No, because it automatically states it in the table if you look on the bottom of the table.
Yeah, this wasn't in your motion. I just wanted to clarify your motion. Your motion was to remove the 5%, but you really meant 5%.
The whole sentence. Yes, because if you look down in the table, it says the 8 permits.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah, so that's the whole sentence, yes.
Any additional discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a vote on the motion. So we have a...
John Wall.
So we have a motion. Joel?
I just want to make sure that the sentence makes sense. Are we removing both in the sheep? We're removing that full sentence, section A, 3A,
remove it.
The current table.
Okay, so as follows, and then it goes through the table.
Yeah.
Cool. I like it. I just want it to make sense. I don't want to readdress this here in another year. Make it clear as can be, right?
We'll remember that next year.
Or is this job security? Is that what this is?
Greg, you have a concern.
No, I just want to make a comment. We've got our Attorney General's office representative here, our lawyer, if you will. So I think if you can kind of get the theme of what you want done, he'll go and get all the right words
he'll
polished
the
up
I's
on
and
there.
Cross the
yeah, he'll make it so it does, we're not just chopping sentences out. But I think the theme of what you're getting at is fine.
That's scary.
Any additional discussion on the motion? Okay, we have a motion to remove the percentages and those, basically remove the sentences that have the percent restrictions and permit restrictions because of on the sheep and the remainder species. Everyone's clear? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Nine in favor? Opposed? One opposed.
I don't know if that would make a whole lot of difference, but...
John? For the whole council, at the last Wildlife Board meeting, some of the Wildlife Board members did request that the chairman ask their council members to state their reason for opposition so that they could understand that. So if you're willing to do that.
I guess it's kind of almost a moot point other than the fact that if we tweak the number of permits that we're basing the 1 or the 2 or the 3 on, if we tweaked those so that those numbers came out so that there wasn't ever a roundup, that's the reason why I did that. It was just to move those numbers to where the roundup never would increase the permit. It would, I think you said it would decrease it by 20 out of 300. Is that?
At the most.
So you were in favor of rounding down.
I'm in favor of rounding down rather than rounding up. And by tweaking those numbers a little bit, I think we could have done that. But
okay,
we'll see how this works.
We'll probably be back next year.
well, we almost certainly will be back next year. Sure, okay. Because the numbers will change, and then since we have a table, if the numbers change, they'll come back to us, and that's okay. That's why we're here.
John, for your since you're new, and Bruce, the Wildlife Board sets the permits, as Ben's talked about. So if the rule changes, we'll see it again, but we won't actually see the allocation of the permits to any groups.
So, maybe.
Yep.
Maybe. I just like to make a little bit of controversy once in a while just to make sure that everybody's thinking right.
Okay. We'll move on to item number 6, collection, importation, and possession rule.
No, you're...
Paul Birdsley? No, this is not...
Hi, Paul.
Actually, I'm Christy Wilson. I'm the Native Aquatic Species Program Coordinator, and I'm in the Salt Lake office. We've been sharing this task in the folks in the Salt Lake office, and so Paul is not here to do that, so I'm going to do that. So find it. First of all, I want to thank this council for taking the time to donate your time to the division and to the public for the wildlife. I think that's an admirable thing that you're doing, and all of us in the division appreciate that. So as I said, I'm going to provide to you guys tonight the amended changes we'd like to recommend for Rule 657.3, which is collection, importation, transportation, possession of animals. The nickname for that is the CIP. So what is the CIP? The CIP, this is a cooperative effort between the Division, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Health. The purpose of this rule is to regulate the possession of wildlife, protect the health, welfare, and safety of the public, and protect the genetic integrity of wildlife and livestock. Wildlife and livestock. This also provides the mechanism for the Division to regulate activities for protected wildlife unrelated to hunting and sport fishing. This governs the issuing of certificates of registration. I'm sure you've all heard of CORs before. That allows collection, importation, possession, and propagation of protected wildlife by the general public. It also defines the activities by which a COR is required. So you've all received this information in your packet, and if you look through it, you notice that it is covered with strikeouts, addition. 99% of what you're seeing are taxonomic and editorial. So what I'm going to provide to you today are basically those issues that we considered to be substantial that we needed to bring to your attention. So in this rule, we have classification of species that fall under three classifications. We have the non-controlled, controlled, and prohibited. Obviously, non-controlled are those species for which that if the public was to collect the species, so if it was to be collected, taken from the wild, if it was to be held in captivity, or if it was to be released back to the wild, if it's non-controlled, we determined that it would not have a detrimental impact to the public or to that population. And a COR is not required. If it's controlled, there is the potential that it could impact the public, the population, or the health and welfare of the public as well. So for that reason, a COR is required. A prohibited species, we've determined that there is a significant detrimental impact. And for that reason, a COR is only issued in accordance with the rule and by federal law. Now, an example of that is if a species is listed endangered or threatened, by our rule, it is considered a prohibited species. So that means that we as a division, we don't really have the authority to grant someone permission to take this animal from the wild unless they are doing research for education, or they have the ability to go in front of the board and grant and obtain a variance. So that's the classification of the species. So I'm going to start with specific sections. So the highlight in green is Section 2. So Section 2 are species that are not covered by the rule. So I'm going to try to go in order here if you want to look through your document. So what we've actually done is these three species are currently in the rule, but what we've added is we've added a little, clarified the language a little bit. When we say species not covered by the rule, what that means is that the cat, the dog, and the swine, they are not covered under this rule. But we did add the clarification about domestic, because there was some folks were confused about when we just said cat. Did that mean a bobcat? Does it mean wildlife, or are we talking domestic? So for these three species, we added the language about domestic. It's so in subsection 4, this is the definitions. So the definition domestic, we added that definition. So it relates to animals that have been selectively bred throughout the generation. They're commonly considered domestic animals that folks have, you know, as pets or that they keep for their personal use. The word animal, we revised the word animal to also include hybrids and the hybrid between domestic and wild animals. And then ornamental fish is a definition. We have revised that to ornamental aquatic animal species. I know that sounds really crazy, but the reason why we did that is that in the pet trade, ornamental fish, people also use crayfish. They also sell crayfish and snails, different types of mollusks that have been released to the wild, and so we have concerns about that. So in this definition, we have changed that to just away from fish to ornamental aquatic animal species. In that new definition, the species that are not included in what's considered ornamental aquatic animal species are sport fish, bait fish, food fish, native species, prohibited or controlled species. Also, we revised this definition in R657-16, which is our aquaculture rule, and fish stocking, and in 59, which deals with our fish ponds. And the reason we did that was because ornamental fish definition occurs in those two rules as well. So we have also changed it in those two rules as well. So moving to section 22, classification and specific rules for crustacean mollusk. We've added two species to be prohibited, the Pylos crayfish, which is the only native crayfish that we have in the state of Utah. It's currently undergoing threats from introduced crayfish. There are two species that have been introduced, so we want that species to be protected. Also, the Stygobromus utahensis, which is an amphipod. It is an endemic cave amphipod found only in one location in the Uinta Mountains in Duchesne County. We want that species in that one location to be protected. It was recently petitioned to list. The Fish and Wildlife Service 90-day finding came back that it was not substantial. The reason for that not substantial was because there had been no impact to that habitat in that area, so they didn't feel that the threats were there, that it needed to be listed. But we as a division want that location and that species to be protected, so we're requesting that it be listed as prohibited. So under Section 22, let's talk about the mollusk. This is just a clarification. In 22, we have listed floaters, and what we want to do, we've listed it as California floater. We want to change that to include all floaters. Floater is a bivalve, which is a freshwater clam-looking species that you can see up there in the left-hand corner. That's how big they get. That is Utah's freshwater clam. We want to make sure there is a lot of taxonomic confusion about the wing floater, the California floater, and there's an Oregon floater. So a lot of the research has not been done within Utah to determine specifically what species we do have. So we want to make sure that we include any bivalve that occurs in Utah, we want it to be protected. Also, spring snails are a very, very small species of mollusk that occur in many of our west deserts. Well, they occur many places in the state, but in many places in the West Desert, they only occur in one location. So they have been petitioned to list by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so what we want to do is protect these locations where we have spring snails, so that if they are petitioned to list and if we have to provide information, we can at least show that we're protecting that habitat where that spring snail occurs. Okay, also within Section 22, we've added three new species to the list. This is the southern tight coil. This is a terrestrial snail found only in a cave in Tooele County. It was also petitioned to lift, and we would like this to be controlled. We would like to see this controlled so that if someone would like to collect it or take some home, at least we could review to see, are there enough animals in the population that could occur? Same for the western pearl shell. This is a river pearl shell with extremely fascinating species. This is the one that's in the top picture there. It's called a pearl shell because when you open it up, the pioneers used to make buttons out of the inside of this shell, and that's why they called it the pearl shell. It looks like a pearl. This species lives to 125 years. It's just amazing. It's 25 years old before it becomes mature. So when we put together this slide, we didn't think we had any in the state. We wanted to make sure that it got put on the list because we're so concerned about this species. Since that time, we have found, in fact, in your region, this region, we have found one and possibly two locations where this species occurs. So for us, that's pretty exciting. And then we also want to consider prohibited. The last species on this list is called the red rim melania. It's called Melanoides. Many of you have probably heard of Melanoides. It is a non-native snail. It's detrimental to native snail populations. We want that to be considered to be prohibited. When a Melanoides gets into a system, it explodes. And you can walk up to a spring, and it will be 2 feet deep with the shells of this species. So they completely alter the entire ecosystem of that spring. So being a non-native, we'd like that to be considered prohibited. Also, in Section 22, we have new language that we've added. So the new language is what I've highlighted in green here. All native species that are not listed in subsection 1 and 2, which were above this sentence, excluding ornamental aquatic animal species, are classified as controlled for collection, importation, and possession. And then we added a new sentence, all non-native species not listed in the above subsections, excluding ornamental aquatic animal species, are classified as prohibited. Then in subsection 23, we have three species that we'd like to add prohibited to the list: the blue catfish, the emerald shiner, and the burbot. These are non-native species that we know have detrimental impacts to native fishes and to our sport fish populations. Now I'm going to move on to we've combined section 7 and 24. This is the classification of specific rules for mammals. So what we try to do here is make the CIP consistent with the non-game mammals rule, which is R657-19. So except as prohibited in the non-game mammals rule, a person is allowed to kill non-game mammals that are causing damage to their property or crops. The non-game mammals rule has provisions to protect bats, prairie dogs, and other sensitive mammal species. So the CIP will regulate the collection and possession of live mammals and the collection of dead mammals for scientific or commercial purposes. So we have removed the option to capture and relocate porcupine, striped skunk, and squirrels. Now, what that means is it doesn't mean that the public will not be able to remove these three species. What that means is, in the rule, that's the non-game mammal rule, 657-19, it's covered in that rule that the public can kill those animals if they are nuisance species. So then in Section 7 and 21, this is the classification and specific rules for birds. A person is not required to obtain a certificate of registration or a federal permit to kill black-billed magpies, cowbirds, house sparrows, European starlings, and domestic pigeons when found damaging personal or real property. So black-billed magpies, cowbirds, house sparrows, European starlings, and domestic pigeons killed pursuant to this section, including their plumage and other parts, may be retained for non-commercial personal use. So subsection 30, propagation of raptors. So again, a lot of this is done to make this rule consistent with R657-20, which is the Utah's falconry rule. So formal approval from the division is required to transfer a raptor from a falconry certificate of registration to propagation use that exceeds 8 months in duration. A licensed raptor propagator may temporarily possess and use a falconry raptor for propagation without division approval provided the propagator possesses a signed and dated statement from the falconer, the person that owns that or holds that falcon, authorizing the temporary possession, and a copy of the falconer's original Fish and Wildlife Service form for that raptor. So now we're going to kind of jump back a little bit to subsection 8. This is for consideration for Canada Goose Nest and Egg Registry. This was created by the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2007 to deal with nuisance Canada geese. This allows agencies and landowners who register online to destroy Canada goose nest and eggs on their property within urban environments from March 1st to June 30th. The take of adults and goslings is not allowed, and they must report their activities annually online. So amending the CIP allows these activities under our state regulations. So Canada goose, urban nuisance problems, and agricultural depredation are very extreme in some areas. From what I understand, our folks in the AVN section work with the public a lot to try to control Canada goose in urban environments. So currently, the state has little we can do with the problem because of the Fish and Wildlife Service regulations. So this program would now allow affected landowners to deal with some of the problem. So it's not expected to have any impact on the wild population. And with that, I thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions, if I may.
One clarification before we go into the questions. As part of the motion, we need to approve R657-16, aquaculture and fish stocking changes. Is that correct?
Say that again.
So in our packet, we have the changes you also made to the aquaculture and fish stocking rule and the private fish ponds rule. Those are all part of this agenda item, are they not?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So just to make sure we cover that in our motion, not just the CIP rule.
Yes.
Okay.
Marty was back there and told me that, yes. Well, so, I know that we changed the definitions in there, but I wasn't aware if it was put in the packet.
It's in there, yes.
Okay. Yes.
Do we have any questions from the public on this agenda item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on the agenda item? Dr. Cabot.
I was wondering if you could clarify for me on R657-3-7 what the amendments or changes are, particularly in 1A. It looks like we've added a species, cowbirds.
Okay, what subsection again?
3-7, take of nuisance birds and mammals.
Okay.
1A, I wasn't clear with the presentation, but it looks like from the proposal here that we've removed American crows and added brown-headed cowbird. Is that correct?
Jim Parrish is here. He's our avian coordinator. He's shaking his head, so I would agree.
So those are the two changes, and I was wondering then if you could explain, well, I guess, and then the other issue is that we've changed the definition for when that's acceptable, and so I was wondering if a little more clarification could be given to allow to explain why one species is removed, another added.
Jim Parrish, Native Terrestrial Species Program Coordinator. The main reason, John, is the service has a depredation order on crows, ravens, and magpies. And not on ravens, just on crows and magpies. Ravens were not included in that because of the potential to take ravens when you think you're taking crows. And so we separated crows and magpies out mainly for the services depredation order, which has been in effect for a little while now.
And then the...
Sorry.
Yikes. I'll just lean. So then the other question was the change in the definition for when found damaging property. So you broadened the definition.
Yes, back to the depredation order again. It's only when crows or magpies are shown to be damaging property or agricultural crops. It's mainly for an agricultural situation. But their language in the depredation order has that restriction. You can't just go out and take willy-nilly. There has to be a documented and indication that you're really having damage from those species before you could move.
So previously, if you had an agricultural issue, that was covered. But now, if I have a black-billed magpie taking my cat food, it seems like it would be potentially okay for me to take
magpies. Where do you live?
Hooper.
None of this supersedes municipality rules or city rules, county rules on discharging firearms or whatever. So those are still in place. So it's mainly for rural situations when you're outside of incorporated areas, although that's not stated that way. But you'd still have to comply with state, city, county rules or limitations on discharging firearms or whatever else you wanted to do. So we didn't. There's nothing in the rule implied to change that.
Okay.
You could snare.
Yeah, you could snare them, I suppose. Yeah.
And then the other. I just wonder if there's any concern that folks, similarly with the confusion of American crow and raven, would confuse brown-headed cowbird and blackbird.
Good point.
Brewer's blackbird, anything else?
Female.
Yeah, females. Good point.
Thank you.
Yep.
So why are cowbirds included?
Why are cowbirds included? There's no particular reason, like magpies or any of the other species. If they're causing damage, we didn't see any reason to restrict removing cowbirds. There's no indication of any issues with the populations.
There's probably considerably larger number of blackbirds than there are cowbirds. I've never seen a large infestation of cowbirds.
That you know of.
Well, they flock together in the winter, but I don't know what the population numbers are, but there's considerable numbers of cowbirds, too.
Ann?
Say again? They do other less than pleasant things, yeah.
So the main reason that crows were taken off the list is because of the confusion issue between those and ravens?
Well, they're covered under a depredation order by the service, mm-hmm. And so there is you have to comply with the restrictions on the depredation order. So we didn't want any confusion with what the service is doing. You can take the crows, but it has to be shown to be that they're damaging in an agricultural situation and with a COR. So we changed them for that reason primarily.
And through the depredation deal, I know in Summit County they're saying that the crows are kind of, they like sage grouse eggs.
They do that.
So I assume that.
Right. Typically when we have that documented, Wildlife Services typically responds to that. And we've had areas where crows are taking sage grouse eggs, and they usually work on that for us.
Okay. Ann?
Thank you. A couple, 4 or 5 years ago, the division explored that particular cave on Kennecott property and could not find that snail that was found in 1929. Is this a precautionary change, or is this, I mean, why the change? Sorry, this might be too personal.
It's precautionary because we haven't paid a lot of attention to our mollusk species. Mm-hmm. Very little surveys have been done. And what we believe is that many of these historical documentations don't cover probably the extent of what is truly the population. So what we would like to do is if we have that protected and we are able to get out there and do more surveys, then we find them in additional locations, then they will be protected.
Okay. So I might have to talk to Marty about what responsibilities landowners have on protecting that cave.
Yes. Well, you can talk to me.
Thank you.
Okay. I oversee that program. And in fact, this year, we are going to focus a good portion of our effort to doing some surveys for, we have 39 species of snails and mollusks that are in the Wildlife Action Plan. So this year, we intend to devote quite a bit of effort to go out to those historical locations, document if they occur there, and then do additional surveys to try to find additional populations. We want to get those species off of the list. So we're going to devote quite a bit of effort this year to surveys for snails.
Thank you.
Additional questions, Jim?
This is not a question, but I'm assuming that under domestic, the definition for domestic, you meant generations, not venerations.
Is it in there it says venerations?
It says venerations, which is a good word, but doesn't apply here.
I
just
figured
I
didn't
know what it meant. Where's that at, Jim?
Is it in
the definition of domestic.
Yes, so that's on number four. Mine says generations. Does yours say venerations?
Yes, it says venerations. Somebody caught it. Okay, good. That's all I want to know. Because we don't want to be charging interest.
You're right. We'll double check that to make sure it's correct in the final version.
Additional questions from the council on the presentation? Seeing none. We have no comment cards from the public. Does anyone wish to comment on this agenda item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Joel.
I have one comment, and I made this comment last year when this came up. But personally, I just don't see the logic in destroying goose eggs and goose nests when there's other options available. And the population in Utah last year was down 40% to 50%, our wild goose population. I think there's better things that we can do than just squashing eggs. So personally, I have a real problem with that. I know it's a federal rule, and this just matches that federal rule, but doesn't mean that we have to do it. So.
Okay. Other comments from the council? John.
I think I'm a little concerned about broadening the situations and when we can remove these species, black-billed magpie, cowbirds, house sparrows, and so forth. It seems to me, and I in no way disagree with the fact that there is certainly times in which these species all can considerably damage agriculture and livestock and that kind of thing. But it seems now that by removing this particular section, we've opened it up to anyone's interpretation. And in addition, it's, you know, there's no reporting requirement or anything. And so I'm concerned with that portion of this.
Ann.
I'd like to echo what John said. I think there needs to be some accountability for what is taken. I've been around enough people to know that a lot of them have no idea what they're shooting or destroying. And so I have some concern about changing the rule to the extent that there could be a lot of incidental type of take or accidental.
You want to address that, Jim?
All of those that are in all of the avian species in that particular section, John, as you know, have other, what should I say, they're less restricted under federal rule as well. However, irrespective of what the Fish and Wildlife Service does, the state has the option to be more restrictive. If this council chooses to do that, we would try to comply with that. That's always the case. Wildlife is a resource of the state and belongs to the wildlife in Utah belong to the people of Utah. So we have the option to be more restrictive if that is of a concern. But there are flexibility with those species on the federal level, which we were trying to comply with, including the depredation order. So.
Thanks. It bothers me that I'm required as a researcher to get a COR just to put a band on a bird's leg, whereas someone to remove any number of these species here, there's no notification at all. So that concerns me.
It doesn't really seem to me like they've loosened it very much. I mean, it's always kind of been an unwritten rule that if a magpie was around, it was doing something wrong, and so you could shoot it. And I don't think this loosens it. It changes. You know, in the old one, it said, when found committing or about to commit, well, okay, he's about to commit, so I'm blasting him. So I think it's different words, but I don't really see it a different, I don't see much loosening of this rule over the old one, frankly. If you want it tighter, then say make it tighter, but.
Well, I don't want to make it tighter. I just want to keep it as it was currently.
About
and that
to commit?
Is that is spelling out those situations in which it's appropriate to take those birds. So, depredations upon ornamental or shade trees, agricultural crops, livestock, or wildlife. And I'm fine with that. I'm a little concerned about adding in cowbirds.
I'm wondering about cowbirds.
Yeah,
as well.
And that concerns me. That we've restricted it now where I see a magpie about to take my cat's food and I can take it because that's my real property.
John Blasser.
Speaking from an agricultural standpoint, anything that simplifies the worries that we have to worry that we're not breaking a rule when we do something impulsively out of madness or terror or whatever. I understand why the crows have to be taken out, but I wish they weren't because they're a real pain in the neck at certain times of the year. You see a calf with its eyes pecked out and you think, boy, I wished I could catch up with that sucker. I'd shoot him. I've killed my share of birds that probably shouldn't have been killed when I was a little kid with a BB gun. So I don't have a problem with spelling out the reasons why we can take these, but I like the idea that I don't have to remember to go get a core before I can do it.
There's no COR requirement before either.
Yeah.
So I mean that wouldn't change. I would just erring.
Yeah, I understand.
Additional comments from the council? Seeing none, we could move on to a motion if someone would care to make one. John Cabot.
I would move that we accept the proposal as presented with a couple of exceptions, and that is under section R657-3-7. That we remove cowbirds and that the original language outlining the conditions for removing these animals be left in. So that section there that reads, a person is not required to obtain a certificate of registration or a federal permit to kill black-billed magpies, will remove cowbirds. House sparrows, European starlings, or domestic pigeons when found damaging. We need to add in back the depredation upon ornamental shade trees, agricultural crops, and livestock or wildlife.
That's what I said.
Yeah. Found committing. Sorry. Thank you. Does that make sense, Jody? No.
So you want to leave in the old stuff and leave in the new stuff except for cowbirds.
I want to, under that section, one, number 1A, leave in A person is not required to obtain a certificate of registration or a federal permit to kill black-billed magpies when found committing or about to commit depredations upon ornamental or shade tree, agricultural crops, or wildlife. And then the additional species that have been added here, house sparrows, European starlings, and pigeons.
And you don't want to add in there, or when concentrated in such numbers?
That's already in the original.
You want to leave that in?
That's in there, yeah.
Okay.
John, can I state it a little
more concisely? Yes, your help would be appreciated.
So your change would be leave it as proposed until you get to cowbirds.
Yes.
Strike cowbirds. After rock doves, you would have
when found
committing or about to commit depredations on ornamental or shade trees, agricultural crops,
correct,
livestock, or wildlife.
Correct.
And you would strike the remaining change, which is when found damaging personal or real property.
Right.
And then scratch American crows.
We would leave the change to
leave
that American crows or magpies, leave that entire strikeout there initially, okay? Then you have the proposed changes to the birds, black-billed magpies. You would strike crows or strike cowbirds. Sorry, you'd leave house sparrows and European starlings, and you would leave or domestic pigeons, rock doves. Then you would just add in the original depredation language, which is
when found committing
or about to commit depredations on ornamental or shade trees, agricultural crops, livestock, or wildlife. Then strike the proposed change when found damaging personal or real property.
I'm not proposing that American crows be added back in.
Well, I didn't think so. I just went out.
Is that clear as mud for everyone?
I'll second it.
Okay.
I like it.
Jody, are we okay?
I'll come back to you.
Okay. So we have a motion from John as stated and a second from Ann.
And we have a question.
And a comment.
And we
for discussion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
we're going to have discussion.
Could you repeat one more time what the how the language would read, please?
Yes.
So take out American.
And this is section 7 and 1A, subsection 1A you're talking about.
Okay. Yes. So
basically,
we get down and you have your first initial strikeouts. That would all remain.
You'd follow the federal.
Except for crow.
No.
Yes.
American crow.
Okay.
Same with
can
crows.
I do it? I got it.
So you could still
I got it.
Crows.
You're sure you got it.
A person is not required to obtain a certificate of registration or a federal permit to kill when found committing.
Just go to Blackfield
Magpie. To kill. Black-billed magpies, cowbirds, house sparrows, European starlings, or domestic pigeons, rock doves, when found damaging personal or real property, or when concentrated such numbers in a manner to constitute a health hazard or other nuisance.
Except cowbirds were struck. We want to take cowbirds out.
All right, I lied.
Basically, everything as you have it currently, or as the rule stands now, we would remove American crow.
I don't know.
Put in your new species with the exception of cowbirds.
Exception of cowbirds. All right.
Yeah.
And the language when found committing or about to commit would stay?
Keep the original.
Including the about to commit?
Mm-hmm. Around.
Yes.
Yes.
How would one demonstrate about to commit? That was part of our questioning when we went through that.
The look in its eyes.
Well, I'm in favor of being more restrictive. However, I'm guessing that that wouldn't fly.
Yeah, and to support the ag people too.
All right. Okay.
You know
okay.
Okay.
So then when there's crows around and cows.
Additional discussion on the motion.
I have one other question on the motion. Are we going to deal with the fish aquaculture fish stocking separately?
As the motion currently stands, yes.
Okay.
Actually, right now we just have a change to the proposal, and then we'll have a motion for the remainder.
For the whole thing.
Yeah, and in that remainder motion, we need to include those two rules.
Okay. numbers.
Additional discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll have a vote. Do I need to restate the change?
No.
Okay, please. Okay, all in favor?
Of the change?
Of the change. 9 in favor, opposed? 1 opposed? Would you state for the Wildlife Board your opposition, please, Jim?
Well, I think it's kind of, I really think it's kind of vague. It still allows you to shoot a magpie whenever you want, and no one's going to do anything about it as long as you let them come on your property and as long as you bury it or burn it or appropriately dispose of it. I just don't think it gains or takes away anything. I think it's exercising futility.
Okay, thank you. Now we need to address the remainder and the two additional rules. Aquaculture and fish stocking and the private fish ponds rules.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that we approve the remainder of the
CIP rule.
Yeah, as well as the attached fish stocking and aquaculture rules, which as presented.
Okay. Aquaculture and fish stocking and private fish ponds
yes.
rules. Okay. Is there a second?
I second.
That's John Wall. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. I think we need to go back real quick to the conservation permit rule and make sure we covered everything there. We probably need to have a motion to approve the remainder of the proposal as presented.
Of Rule 657, right?
Yeah, that was 657.
Because we just approved John's amend or
well,
change.
I'm talking about the conservation permit rule, and we made the changes that Bryce. That my note.
Yeah. So no. We're talking about the last motion.
Yeah, actually, we need to jump back to number 5 and make sure we covered everything on that item. I think the motion was just to change the wording on those two items, and we need to make sure we approve the remainder of the rule as proposed.
I thought at the first reading that's what John said.
That's what I thought so too.
Well, like you're talking about number 4 and 5, like
well,
the mechanisms and everything like that.
Number 5, yeah.
Okay.
And I think the motion was just to change the wording on those two items.
Yeah.
Is that? Was that your original motion, was just to change the wording on those two
and number 3, right? Yeah, so just accept number...
Wait.
Yeah, so we... Like, 1 deals with the turkey hunt, or turkey permits.
Right.
We
just need to have a motion to adopt the remainder of that... conservation permit rule and amendments.
Okay.
As presented.
Make a motion to adopt the remainder of the conservation permit programs.
Permit rule and amendments.
Permit rule and amendments. Specifically 1, 2, 4, and 5.
So, just as presented.
As presented.
Okay. Okay, we have a motion from Bryce and a second from Russ. I really need a break. To recommend the Wildlife Board approve the remainder of the conservation permit rule and amendments. Discussion on the motion.
Well, as long as we're revisiting it, I might as well air my gripe that I wasn't going to air in the beginning, and that is I think we're giving the turkey permit holders more than they really need. They've already got from April 1st to May 31st to kill a turkey, and all they're restricted is in the unit that they originally applied for. Rather than, so now we're going to say you can hunt statewide, and yeah, I can hunt statewide with an over-the-counter permit, but I mean, we give them 2 months, and they already chose where they wanted to hunt. Why give them any more? I know they're paying more, but that's why not relevant. We've already given them enough, I think.
Okay. Additional discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor? It's unanimous. Thank you. Let's have a 15-minute break. Is that okay, Greg? Thank you. Greg?
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Greg Sheehan, Wildlife Resources in Salt Lake. This next rule change, R657-57, is the division variance rule. Give you kind of a quick background on what this really is. This isn't a rule that really comes out to the racks a lot, or the results of this aren't really addressed a lot at rack meetings. But basically, it's a rule that we have in place that addresses variance requests when somebody becomes ill or injured. It's kind of the typical scenario. And the Wildlife Board established this rule about 4 years ago. So that, and it created a committee to address this. Prior to the committee having a division committee to address these situations, all of these requests came to the Wildlife Board. And there started to be a pattern of enough of these types of requests coming there. They said, maybe we kind of know where these things are going. What if you were to create a rule so you can address these, and then some of the oddball situations we may still need to address as a board. So we put a rule in place about 4 years ago. One of the components of the rule said that requests must be made within 200 days of a season. So if you're ill or injured or got one of these circumstances, you got to come to us within 200 days of the season closure to address a request for relief. Now, as I mentioned, the board still handles some exceptions that are outside of what the jurisdiction or the authority of this division variance committee can address. Generally speaking, most of the approved variances result in season extensions that allow the hunter to hunt with their permit the following season. So typically it's been if you get hurt or injured or have cancer or something that may come up in your life that precludes you from hunting with a permit that you've drawn, most of these resulted in season extensions. Now the distribution of you know what brings these to being with us is about 60% of those are people who are ill or injured themselves. About a third are people who have an illness or injury in an immediate family member, a few military and a few others. So that's kind of, you can see the vast majority of all these are dealing with illness or injury. This table here, this graph, is kind of what's got us concerned that maybe we needed to readdress this rule now that we've had a few years to see how it's working out. And these are variances that have been approved by either the Division Variance Committee or the Wildlife Board. So back prior to 2008, the board was hearing about 20 of these situations per year. And that's when they asked us to create a rule to, you know, thinking that we could kind of address these 20 situations, you know, roughly 20 or so situations a year. Well, the rule we put in place may have been a little bit too liberal, some can argue, or you know, maybe we've just made people more aware of the circumstances or the things that are out there. But we've seen kind of an exponential growth in people who are interested in coming in and asking for these sorts of variances. So, and I've listed here kind of the species categories or hunt categories, if you will, that we've had these variances granted in. This graph here shows you who actually approved those variances. So before 2008, those were all done by the board. After the rule came in, the taller columns were the ones in blue, or the ones that were approved by the division, and then the lower numbers, to the right or in the red are the ones that are still gone to the board. So as you can see, there's still some going to the Wildlife Board, but not as many as there used to be. But we have a large number now going to this variance committee. We had 148 that the committee approved this year. So the basis for the change in the rule, or why are we bringing this to you, and what is it we want to accomplish? First of all, we want to make sure that we have everyone know that we're acknowledging that sometimes unforeseen events happen in life, and we're trying to make our sportsmen whole in the best logical manner. But it's also acknowledged that if we continue with that exponential growth of pushing all these permits into a future year, that eventually that may have a resource impact, because these permits are added on top of the permits that are approved for the following year. Finally, the division needs to minimize any financial impact, so we don't want to get in a situation where we're giving a lot of people their money back and different things. And we don't on those now for the ones that we've granted those variances, but we feel like we can't financially insure, you know, everybody who draws a hunting permit. So the variance relief that we're proposing, the division may grant a variance to a person that is substantially precluded from hunting because of these categories listed here: personal injury or illness, death or significant injury to immediate family member, military deployment or mobilization. And then one other change we've got here is instead of 200 days, we're proposing to be reduced to 120 days. They need to approach us. So there's no guarantees, simply because they come to us, and there hasn't been in the past. We've still got some discretion to exercise, and probably the biggest area is they come in and say, I was injured, here's a doctor's note, I want to have my elk tag good for next year. You know, we've got to sometimes look at that and say, you know, was this a severe enough injury? You know, did you break your finger, and so now you want to have your elk tag good for next year? You know, and grant some kind of latitude as we address those. But honestly, this isn't a program that we believe has been abused. I think really almost all of the situations that have come to us have been pretty legitimate. People draw these permits, and I don't think most people's first intent is, well, I think I'll use it next year. You know, most of these are pretty legitimate life-altering events. Okay, I mentioned earlier substantially precluded. So it said if you're substantially precluded, then we can have a variance discussion. So the way we're defining precluded is if you hunt one day or less in the field, you're precluded. Any amount of time spent during a single day is considered a full day. So what we're saying here is if you go out and hunt for a day and then get hurt on day two or three or eight or whenever, we'll have considered you hunted. But if you just come the first day, maybe you're out on your horse and you fall off that afternoon or have a heart attack or something that first day, then you could come in and it has the same effect of saying as you'd never hunted at all. Okay, so what are we going to do now? What's the change that we're talking about here? Variances are limited to waiting period, bonus and preference point restoration, or season extension, and I'll talk about which ones of those apply. So first one, preference point restoration. So if you go out there and were substantially precluded from any of these hunts, general season deer, pronghorn, sharptail, I'll let you read all those, but essentially you're not eligible for a season extension. But we'll give you your points back, and we'll also give you the point you would have earned for that year. So if you had two preference points and you draw and then you were injured, you'd get your two back plus one that you could go into the draw the next year. Okay, the next category would be all of our bonus point species. Hunts eligible for this would also get their points back, and I'll go over what some of these categories are. There's non-bonus point hunts that incur a waiting period. These are sportsmen and conventions, so we can't give you your points back on these types of permits because you didn't have any points to draw them. But what we can do is not use up your waiting period. So right now, if you say go to the convention and draw once in a lifetime and then can't participate, or don't harvest, you're not eligible to go back to a regular drawing and ever apply for those again because you've used up your once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. What we're saying here is that if these conditions occur and you're injured or whatever, we can restore your period so you can come back and still keep applying the division draw. The next category, once-in-a-lifetime. And this is one that's had a lot of conversation, if this should be moved to a season extension. Right now we say if you draw once in a lifetime, you're injured or ill or those other circumstances, that you could get your points back plus the one. Some of our RACs have expressed some concern. The Central Region RAC last night voted to move this to a season extension on once in a lifetime. The other RACs didn't. Other ones we've got here, limited entry, public CWMU, antlerless moose. So any of these categories aren't eligible for a season extension. Okay, ones that are eligible for a season extension. We've got conservation permits, poaching reward permits, which we've never had any of. Private CWMUs, if the landowner will approve that. So that takes approval of the landowner as well, and limited entry landowner. And let me explain why we've got season extensions here. Most of these permits, all but the poaching ones, involve a situation where somebody could come in, we'll say February of any given year, and buy a conservation permit or a CWMU or landowner permit, maybe in February. That hunt comes this fall. They hunt or don't hunt, maybe they're injured. And 120 days later, which could be a full year from when they bought that, they come back and say, I want to apply for an extension. Well, we can, at that point in time, these groups, maybe if it's conservation permit, that's a year has passed since they bought this thing. By then, we may have already gotten all that money and spent it. So we can't say, well, okay, Hunter, go back to whatever sportsman's group and have them give you your money back, because they probably won't have it at that point in time. Private CWMU operators may have spent that for leases or different things. So we don't really want to be pushing people back to third parties asking for a lot of money back. So we're recommending in these situations that they extend those hunts. And I did mention on the CWMU, if they can go to the landowner and say, okay, landowner, you might have 10 whatever deer tags next year. By approving this extension, you're going to have 11. If they'll agree to that, then they could have the extension. If the landowner doesn't want to participate, then they wouldn't be able to have that extended to the next year. So that's something that they need to work through, but we don't want to be, you know, it's very difficult for us to be pushing things on private property owners that way. Okay, next category. We're getting closer. Group members receive the same variance relief granted the division to any single member of the group under this rule. So basically what we're saying here is, if you applied as a formal group in the application, maybe two of you applied for a limited entry bull elk, you draw the permit and one of you gets hurt and are eligible for an extension. We've had situations where, getting your points back. We've had situations where we have these groups, they come back in, maybe they're a father and son, or maybe they're two non-residents who live far away. And now we're fracturing this hunt and putting it into two different years. And a lot of them, it's very problematic because they just haven't, you know, they don't want to hunt in two separate years as two separate individuals. So what we're saying is, whatever we'll do for the one person in the group, we'll do for everyone in the group. And keep in mind, this is mostly giving you your points back in most situations. And there just isn't, you know, most people, if they get that permit, they want to hunt if there's any way they can. But groups sometimes have had some difficulties with that. Last slide I have, the board cannot consider grant variance. If all those criteria are met, 120 days, they've hunted more than a day, they didn't kill an animal, if those different criteria happen, this rule would preclude the board from hearing an appeal of that. So most of our rules right now, basically all of our rules, if you don't like how you're addressed with the division, you can appeal something to the board. And the board gets appeals from time to time for different things. This says if all of these criteria were true, you can't, and you don't like the outcome or you don't like the fact, you can't go back to the board. And the board, I think, is very interested in having this component because they want this dealt with solidly. This has taken a lot of time for our wildlife board to address these kinds of things. And if this rule is passed and everyone agrees to this criteria, they want everyone to have to stick with it, not, you know, have this be round one is talk to a variance committee, and if you don't like the state today, then go to the board and maybe they'll give you a different answer. So that's all I've got tonight on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Are there any questions from the public on Greg's presentation? Seeing none, Greg. On two of your slides, the substantially precluded for the board and the division, our material we've been provided has 2 days.
Yeah, we were kicking around if you hunted for 2 days, and then Stacy sent out an update, I think, last Monday to all the RAC and board members. Should have gone out.
Okay.
That changed it to 1 day. So
I've been out of town, so I probably didn't catch up on all my emails.
And you might not have caught it because it's, you know, a one-word difference in a big, thick rule. But essentially what we were trying to do, we were going to do 2 days, and then there was some concern internally and with some other discussions we had that basically said, maybe 2 days is too long to have hunted and go one. This is kind of a social thing. I don't know what the right answer. It could be 1 or 2 or 10 or 50 or whatever, you know. So, but what we did want to acknowledge is that there's some circumstances where people go out in the field, and it seems to commonly happen on day one, is people get out there with their horses and fall off and break their leg or have a heart attack or crash your ATV, and it seems like we hear a lot of, you know, this happened the first morning of the first time. You know, a lot of people get out in situations they're not familiar with and get hurt. So we just wanted to, you know, have some latitude to be able to address that. But at some point in the hunt, you've sort of had an opportunity to kill something. And where what that is, who knows, you know. We've all had good hunts if you're a hunter, and we've all had bad hunts, you know. But we put 1 day in here, so
okay,
you
so
can address how you want.
Your presentation is 1 day.
Yes, so, and okay. That should be the current, the most recent thing that you got from Stacy.
Right. Thank you. Additional questions from the council on the presentation? Bryce.
On that once-in-a-lifetime that you talked about moving over to the season extension instead of the bonus point restoration, would it be too much of a stretch to just on that category alone let them choose between a bonus point restoration or a season extension? We're only dealing with...
Yeah, we could...
I mean, let them choose between both of them. Just because that's... It's a once-in-a-lifetime.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, on those once-in-a-lifetime, you're dealing with people that have been putting in for a long time.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah,
at least
give
them a chance.
Yeah, they can surrender it back and have that extension or get, you know, get their points back. Or if you made a motion to move it, which they did last night, but some of the other acts didn't, you know, so...
Well, I just don't
to
see.
Move just that category into this season extension category, because it is difficult to draw those permits, you know. And we haven't had a lot of. If I can go back to this, graph here.
You've only had.
You've seen this exponential growth, but you haven't seen really an overwhelming growth in the once in a lifetime. I think most people who draw those want to go use them, you know, because. You don't even know, you know, what the next year holds. You know, not many people want to wait a year to use these permits if they get them.
Well, yeah, because my wife's grandpa 2 years ago drew a sheep tag. He was 74. He couldn't hunt this year if he wanted to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would rather have him seen a season extension, but give some people the chance at a bonus point restoration if they want to do that. So put it in both categories, just for once in a lifetime.
Well, I think... our attorney Marty's here. I'm going to ask you. Marty, they would be able to, they would always have the option, I suppose, to surrender that or get their points back, right? We don't need to have it in both categories, do we?
Yes.
We do? Okay. We could say, you know, optionally, it could be in both. It could be in this category, if I'm understanding the proposal
list it,
right. Could be here at their discretion, if they qualify for all this variant stuff, at their discretion to get their points back or have it automatically. There could be a situation where they want it back. If you've got maximum points and you're not sure if you're going to be healthy again by next year, you may want your points back.
Exactly.
Because at max points, you're going to draw.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
most people aren't there. I'm not there with any of that.
Yeah,
stuff.
You might be healthy the next year, but at least if you get healthy,
that's kind of a different twist that nobody's talked about, but maybe not in a bad one. So.
After the council, okay. Additional questions from the council? Ryan, you have a question from the public.
Yeah, real quick. I'll just be quick. I'm just going to bring this one up because it did happen, and I'll use it. A guy from Washington actually bought a conservation permit, and I don't want to bring
that
in.
It's a question, right?
What's that?
It's a question, right?
It is a question.
Okay.
But I got to lead up to it so it makes sense, because there was one point on here about the what the board, I think you're taking away all the authority of the board on one of them if they hunt one day. The guy broke his foot on the second day going into the Dirty Devil. I would hate to see a guy, what Bryce is bringing up, had a bunch of points, broke his leg, and then he has no recourse because he did hunt one day. He hasn't killed anything. Maybe you're moving camp in. Is that too restrictive? Or do you guys just want it one day and then it's said and done and everybody goes away? I mean, because right here, if I'm looking at, you have that slide that's under the limitations of the board authority.
Yeah.
Board cannot consider a grant. It's meaning it's done. If we pass this,
one day
nobody has any recourse to go towards the board for anything. And that's troubling for me, just for the once in a lifetime guys. So my question is
do you want to comment
on?
Question
in there, but that's kind of a comment.
Comment. Okay, we'll get to comments here. Stand right there. I think we're done with questions. Yeah. We'll go to comments from the public. You're sitting down now, so Troy's going to be first.
Troy Jessenson, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. Last night they passed a different version of this, moving the once-in-a-lifetime over to the season extension. But I think Bryce brings up a great point that, you know, if we could possibly move the once-in-a-lifetime variances over to give them an option either to a season extension or to get their points back, that'd be a great idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Ryan?
Can I just say, hey, all that I said before, it's on record. Are we good with that? I'll turn the card in.
You have a concern with the board limitation on one day.
I just have a concern that you're going to take all of that authority away. Not you, but I mean, if this passes and goes that well, I mean, nobody really has any kind of recourse. If I was packing in on the Zion unit for a day to set camp up and the hunt was open, and I went out and hunted the next day, the second day, and I broke my ankle, I'm done. I'm done. If I understand this correctly, is that correct, Ernie?
Well,
meaning I don't have. There is no recourse to come back and say, "Hey, I'm."
In your example, though, if you're packing in and you didn't actually hunt that day, that probably would not be a day hunting.
But I'd be carrying a rifle. The season would be open, so now it's left open to interpretation, and that's where you get into the real gray area. And I'm not saying 2 days is actually the magic number. What I'm saying is that you have somebody with a once-in-a-lifetime tag, and they're, and all I'm alluding to is kind of where Bryce was going with. I don't want to overburden you guys with this, but I would hate to take out some flexibility that the Wildlife Board would have. That's
okay. I want that card. Any additional comments from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments?
Right.
So, could we propose maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 days for the once-in-a-lifetime and leave it 1 day for the rest of them? I mean, is that getting too confusing? But I see the point. I mean, somebody draws a once-in-a-lifetime. I mean, it's a once-in-a-lifetime. It's the rest of them, you might not or might have another chance, but maybe for the once-in-a-lifetimes, at least go back to the 2-day rule.
However you guys want to present, whatever. This is largely a social issue that we're dealing with. This isn't much of a resource issue, the kind of conversations we're having. But I could tell you one thing, the board, and we have a board member here, but we a lot of these go to the board who've hunted. All of them do, actually. And we've had people who've hunted 3 days and 5 days and 7 days, and I hunted the first weekend and nothing, but I came back the second weekend and got hurt. It's difficult. That's why we're bringing this out. It's encompassing at some of these board meetings, hours of board meeting days, to ponder the kinds of things you're talking about right now. It's I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know if we could ever get it, because there's a lot of weird situations that happen out there, and all of them have merit. I don't think the board's heard a lot of these. It didn't have some merit behind it. So
I'd almost propose then if we just stuck with the what the division's recommending on all of the this all of the regular hunts, on them the once in a lifetime, take out the days and just let the wildlife board hear the request and let them make the decision. Not base it on any days, but just whether it be two or four, if something tragic was to happen, let the wildlife board. Everything else revert to this rule, but once in a lifetime, let the wildlife board handle it.
I think you'd still need a number of days, and if they wanted to appeal that because they only had one day, that could be a basis to go to the board. But the board would never hear any of these until some trigger happened, and so that trigger would be, I got hurt on my second day. Now I want to go to the board, or my fifth day, or whatever. So, if that makes sense.
Joel?
I was just going to make a comment. I think we need to recognize, too, that this is hunting. You know, just because you draw once in a lifetime doesn't guarantee a harvest. And there's all sorts of things that happen besides personal injury that can mess up a hunt. And so there's no guarantee in this. And, you know, life's tough. We have to deal with ups and downs. And if there's a rule that we all have to live with, I just, you know, making the board review every single one of these just seems a little ridiculous to me, which is what your rule is trying to address. And so, you know, you break a leg, you get bucked off your horse, whatever it might be, that kind of stuff happens. And it's sad, but it's part of life. And so I think that we need to recognize that there is no guarantees in this, and that there does need to be, I think there should be some sort of a guideline like what you're saying.
One thing I could tell you, with what we've proposed here or any variation that you may come up with, we looked at all the other states, we're so much more relief oriented than any other state out there. It's ridiculous. Some states is too bad for you, you know, shouldn't have had that happen. Some have a few situations where they'll grant relief. Like Wyoming does it on sheep and moose. Just those two species, they'll do it. But most states don't do anything or do very little. So all of this, either the old rule or anything we come up with, is still pretty liberal if you look around our neighboring states.
Bruce.
I have a question. Speaking of other states, I believe Nevada will grant a variance. You can actually surrender your permit. And I think what that really does is it creates an incentive for those people to actually want to put in for various hunts. And when they get the big one, the once-in-a-lifetime, NDAO allows them to surrender. But what they do is they keep the money.
We have a surrender rule as well.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, that works similarly. So you can surrender your permit here up until the day of the hunt. So, yes. And you can get your money back up until within 30 days of it. You can have your money back, too.
Wow.
So.
Should consider changing that.
This has nothing to do with surrender.
No. Yeah, that's a different rule that we have.
Yeah. Bryce, sorry. Granted, things happen. Life, you know, throws curveballs at us, but at least on the once in a lifetime, I'd like to see at least two or three days.
Oh no, I don't disagree.
You know, or,
I don't know that we just the wildlife board needs to see every.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking only five or six a year, isn't that right? For once in a lifetime ones, at least.
Yeah.
And that's the only one I was concerned about.
I agree with that.
So.
So make Jim. A motion.
Okay, are we finished? Everybody's had a chance to discuss? Good. Okay.
I'd like to make a motion that we approve it as accepted, except for once-in-a-lifetime big game be allowed to be in the season extension and be granted 3 days grace period instead of one.
Can I restate?
Three hunt days, yes.
Yeah, okay. So you recommend the Wildlife Board approve the division variance rule as presented, with the exception of once-in-a-lifetime big game would be, and I think you want it to be bonus point or season extension.
Yes.
Okay. And you want, pick a day, two or three.
Three.
You want a three-day hunt.
Trigger.
Yeah. Applicant hunts no more than 3 days on once-in-a-lifetime species.
Yes.
And no board variance relief?
That would be on the board variance relief. That would be, the trigger would be applicant hunts no more than 3 days.
Okay, so there's two places then. One is back where we talk about how many days you hunted that the division can address it. And then, Bryce, is what you're saying, that you can, if you hunted more than 3 days and didn't harvest and you were injured, then you could appeal it to the board if you hunted more than 3 days?
No. You can't even apply, right?
Like, this says you cannot even consider a variance if you've hunted more than 1 day.
Right.
What are you saying?
No, the board can't hear an appeal of that.
Right.
If you've hunted more than a day.
And so we're saying your board can't hear an appeal if you've hunted more than three. So basically you're done.
Once in a lifetime.
So if you go hunt 3 days and then break your leg and you haven't harvested yet, the board still can't hear it.
Yes.
So really this hasn't got anything to do with the board, if I'm understanding. It's just where we talk about precluded right here, we would change the rule would say 1 day or less hunting for all species except once in a lifetime.
Three days or less. Yes.
And the thing about the board holds true.
Yeah.
If that's what you're asking.
Yes.
Well, I think you have to change both of them, don't you? Because the board's authority is listed separately.
Yeah. And then the board one would say applicant hunts more than 1 day or 3 days for once-in-a-lifetime species.
Okay, yeah.
If that's what I think I understand.
Is in the actual rule, is the preclusion only listed in one place?
The board's authority is a different place.
Is that listed specifically 1 day in the board's authority, mm-hmm. or does it just say precluded there?
It probably says precluded.
Okay.
I have to have our attorney who wrote it, who's sitting back there. Staring at me right now. So it's two separate places. But if you make a motion, he'll fix the rule to be whatever you want, if that's what passes.
Marty, Jody says you have to come to the mic if you're in the background giving us advice.
Jody's on a roll.
Even you have to comply.
I just thought it was something so nominal to add that I didn't really need to be on the record. But Marty Bushman, Utah Attorney General's Office, author of the variance rule. The preclusion for one hunt day binds both the division under its authority and the board under the board's respective authority, and it appears in two places in the rule. So if the motion is to change it to 3 days, question is it changed just on the, can the board only consider it 3 days while the division's bound to one, or do you want both the board and the division to have 3 days?
If we just change the definition of the preclusion, would it apply throughout the rule?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. And we can, whatever you want, we can write the rule to make it work.
Okay.
Just got to make sure I understand what you want.
Thank you.
Okay.
So your motion will just change the definition of preclusion for once-in-a-lifetime species to 3 days hunting.
Okay, thank you.
3 days. Do we have a second?
I will.
Russ? We got some long-winded motions tonight. Justin wants me to restate the motion. Jokingly. Jokingly, and I will work out the exact verbiage. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, all in favor, say aye. Please raise your hands. It's unanimous. Thank you very much. We'll move on to deer management plans with Darren.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I hope this works out well.
If not, we'll see you in 4 years.
Should be a five-year rule.
Yeah, that's 5 years.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to try to keep this as concise as possible. And, of course, if you have any questions, then we'll discuss as necessary. So tonight I'm going to be, it's up to your pleasure, but I can present both and we can consider them together, or I can present deer and then do elk. Mr. Chairman, whatever.
We need to vote on each one separately. So
right. Okay, we'll just do that then.
Yeah.
All right, we'll start with deer. This is just a map of the northern region deer and elk management units, just for your reference. And those are the units we'll be talking about tonight. And hold on. This isn't my computer, so there we go. We'll begin with deer management plans. This is just a quick list of what is contained in a deer management plan. First of all, it describes the boundary of the management unit. Second of all, describes land ownership and acreage, just to try to define who owns what. Thirdly, and probably most importantly, defines what the population objective will be for each management unit, and then strategies to obtain that objective, habitat objectives, and strategies to address habitat objectives, and the final piece is a range trend DCI, which is the desired components index of winter range for mule deer specifically. And that ranking describes the conditions on winter range within a management unit, and that pertains to the number of deer that would be recommended in the population. So if the DCI indicates that winter ranges are in poor condition, the unit would then be able to support lower numbers of deer than it would if that component index was high and you had all the desired components. That's an index that's based on different kind of desired plants and makeup of the trend site. And so if you have further questions on that, I can go further into that. So these are the northern region mule deer units. One thing I wanted to make clear on these is that the DCI is based on range trend analysis that occurs on a five-year rotation. So the range trend crew does the analysis on a different region every year, and they make a circle of the state. And so the way that works is we try to do deer management plans right after that's read. So those were read in the northern region last year. This summer we will actually be readdressing these plans. And so the plans that we're looking at tonight are not going to be significantly changed from what they were in the past, but we did need to renew them because they expired. But we will be going back through these plans this summer and bringing back plans this time next year. And so the only exception to that is the North Slope, which is split between us and the northeastern region. That unit was read 2 years ago, and that plan is actually based on a new DCI, and so that one will remain in effect. But the rest of them are going to be readdressed this summer. So the stuff you have tonight is going to be pretty much what it was the last time around. I'm sorry, I thought you might be. So if you look here, those are the objectives, and also population estimates. It's based on a modeled population. So you can kind of see where we are in terms of population objectives. And that's pretty much it for deer.
Did I miss the asterisk?
Yeah, that's the north slope. So that's one that actually is going to... That plan was done by the Northeastern region in conjunction with us. That plan is a good five-year plan. That one won't come back next year, but the rest of them will. The rest will be addressed this summer and into the fall. Again.
Thank you, Darren.
Yep.
Do we have any questions from the public on Darren's presentation? Seeing none. Questions from the council? Kim.
Are the DCI rankings based upon a reference site or a benchmark?
They're based on the range trend sites. So they're depending on the unit, there could be anywhere from 8 to 12 sites. And that the ranking is based, it's actually per site. So and what we've tried to do is select representative sites throughout a unit for winter range.
So that's a reference. That's
so
what
this
I
is a reference
okay.
site, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Additional questions from the council?
Those are all winter units? They're all in the winter?
Primarily, area? Yeah. Mule deer winter range is what they're looking at. The DCI pertains directly to that.
Yeah. Russ.
Darren, on those DCIs, just say 50 acres burned where that site is. Not substantial in the winter range. Is there a human element to kind of sort through that and interpret that?
Yeah, we have moved sites. We like to maintain a site whenever possible because then it gives us a long-term data trend. If you have a chance to look at those range trend studies, it's fairly interesting. Some of these have photo plots that go back to the 80s, and it's eye-opening on some of them what's changed. But if we have a burn or if there's a housing development that goes in or something like that, we'll discontinue that site and try to pick another site if possible. So, yeah.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to comments from the public. Byron?
Byron Bateman, president of SFW. I just want to say that we glad to see you go to the DCI index and stuff like that. We'd like to see more habitat work done here in the northern region, and we just support the recommendation. I'd like to see these numbers that are below 70% on the percent of objective, get those back up as high as we can, get as close to that 100% number as possible for the mule deer. So we just support the division's recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Byron. Is there any additional public comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comment on the presentation. And Darren, we will see these after the range trend study again.
Okay. Right. The range trend was done last year, so we'll be rewriting plans this summer, and I assume at this meeting next year you'll see new updated deer plans.
Great, okay. Jim.
I move we accept the studies and recommendations of the mule deer plan as presented.
We have a second from John Cabot. So the motion from Jim Gaskell and second from John Cabot is to recommend approval of the deer management plans as presented. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none. All in favor? You say aye.
Aye.
Raise your hand. It's unanimous. Or unanimous? Okay, thank you.
All right, moving into elk plans. Now, unlike the deer plans, these elk plans are for the next 5 years. And so you'll see more changes in these than you did in the deer plans. We had a basic approach to elk plans this year. If we had an elk unit that we thought we were going to change the objective on, especially increase the objective, we had a committee put together. What we did is we had three of those units, and I'll show you which ones those are coming up, where we had a kind of a committee that addressed all of them in one shot. And Craig and John were on that committee, And I'll, again, I'll, as we move forward, I'll show you which ones those were. The other unit plans were revised without committees. And so this is the opportunity for the public input on those plans. All the plans, you know, were considered by the various sections, wildlife, habitat, and law enforcement within the DWR. This is the committee that looked at the Chalk Creek, East Canyon, and Camas units. So those units were the ones that were considered by committee. There's a list of names there. Just as a point of reference at the bottom, there were some people that were invited and weren't able to make. It only took one meeting, and probably obviously missing would be RMEF, and Bill just couldn't make that meeting, and so they weren't there for the discussion, but were invited. So here's the elk units. The ones in yellow are the ones that that had the committee consideration, and they're also the ones that had some changes. And so you can see the objectives, the population estimates, and our recommended changes to those. And I'll go through each. Well, do I need to back up, Ann? Do you have a question? Okay. I'm going to go through the ones where we're actually changing or at the committee considered, and then if you have questions on the others, of course, feel free. Beginning with East Canyon, we left that objective the same. That unit is over objective by a fair amount, but the district biologist and we felt like it had the objective was a realistic objective for elk. We didn't want to increase it. And so we left it where it was. That's going to mean some considerable effort in terms of reducing that herd, and we intend to do that as part of the plan. The concerns the biologist had was that there looks like there's some overutilization of habitat, and we just felt like, you know, it's got too many elk, and we don't need that many elk. The next one was the Chalk Creek unit. We raised that objective by 500 animals. We felt like it could handle that increase. Having said that, the unit is at 191% of objective, and so this still means, even though we raised the objective, it still means we're really going to have to bring those numbers down to meet objective. So that'll be occurring on that unit as well in terms of antlerless type hunting. Both the East Canyon and Chalk Creek units are comprised of largely private land, and so we had some discussions in the committee about how to achieve that goal because of access and the limitations for access. So we're going to try to come up with some ways to do that as part of the plan. And finally, Camas. We increased the objective on the Camas by 200 animals. We felt like the habitat could sustain the increase. Once again, Camas is over objective. It was flown two winters ago, and it's about 130% of objective. So again, this represents a decrease in overall elk numbers, but a little bit less significant decrease than what the old objective would have been. So that's all I have. Any questions?
Questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing none. Questions from the council? Ann, did you have a question?
Well, yes, I guess I do. I can ask the general group. So maybe I misunderstood, but it seemed like that you were trying to increase the deer populations in Camas. Was that correct?
Right now, the current plan it doesn't represent an increase over the old objective.
Right, but you're not meeting objective. Thank you.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
But you're going to up the elk objective. Is that potentially, do they conflict?
That's a difficult question. I think in some areas and in some instances they do, and typically it's because elk inhabit an area that deer are excluded from. I've got Dave here tonight. If Dave, if you want to maybe speak to that a little bit on the CAMAS unit specifically.
Well, I was just looking at the numbers, and it just didn't seem intuitive to me that, I mean, I know that there's a lot of studies that say that they're not necessarily competitive, but
right.
Then there's also some that say that they could be.
That's kind of where we are. We don't have any hard evidence that that's occurring, but that was a concern on the East Canyon unit, and that was one of the reasons why we didn't increase that objective. But Dave, if you want to address CAMAS, that'd be great.
I'm Dave Rich, Summit County Wildlife Biologist. On the CAMAS unit, the population objective before the plan was 650. We, with the committee and everybody, we come together to, and we added 200 animals up to 850. That number largely came from years past. That population objective on the CAMAS, I think it was eight years ago, was 850. And for whatever reason, I wasn't part of that discussion or part of that process. They reduced it back to 650. And so our committee's recommendation was just to, take it back up to what it normally was. There is ample habitat to support those animals. We haven't had any depredation issues to speak of. The range is in pretty good shape. The CAMAS unit is, there's a lot of forest on that. There is some private, and we're able to pretty much take care of the depredation issues as they occur.
So you're not worried about the deer population being...
We're not seeing that much overlap between the deer and the elk on that CAMAS unit.
So do you have any idea why it's not meeting objective of the... than drought and other things like that?
Deer population numbers are down pretty much statewide, so that's what we attribute that to.
All right, thank you.
I think I'll put in a plug for the stuff we're doing now, the email that I sent out about these sort of use transects. That can be an eye-opening experience if you're interested, to kind of see what they're using. And also, if you get a chance to look at those range trend studies, it's fairly clear that elk probably aren't the major issue in all areas. We've basically gone from brush on some units to grass, and that's why we don't have the deer that we do. So, but on the CAMAS, we felt like there wasn't enough competition that wasn't a concern. Yeah.
Additional questions from the council? Seeing none. We'll go to comments from the public. Byron.
Again, I just want to echo what I said earlier about, I want to see a lot more habitat work in the northern region because that's what's critical for deer and elk. We support the division's recommendations. We'd also like to go on record as supporting, the balance of the statewide recommendations that you all have there as part of what you have. Your packet should be included in that, is the elk increases the rest of the state. And there's going to be a new open bull unit that's proposed on the west side of the Oak Creek and the Beaver. But we support the division's recommendations. It's a great opportunity to increase, opportunity for a lot of people in the state of Utah across the state with these elk plans and these deer plans. So thank you.
Thank you, Byron. Darren, that wasn't part of your presentation, but that I do see that on part of the bottom of the packet there.
I was just trying to address the regional stuff, so if I missed something, I apologize.
So there is a recommendation changing the Fillmore Oak Creek South and part of the Beaver unit west of I-15 to general any bull units. And that should be part of our motion,
right.
Correct? Okay. Council should have seen the other changes in other regions, which are probably part of our motion also. There is an increase in elk numbers to plus 350 on the Avantaquin, plus 150 on the West Desert, plus 175 on the Fillmore, and plus 800 on the Fish Lake. There's a decrease of 35 on the Paunsagunt. Are there any questions on those from the council, since I just brought that up? Okay. Seeing none. Comments from the council?
Mainly just private land, CWMUs.
I have one.
Yes, John.
I'd just like to comment that when we were in this group discussing the elk in those three areas, the consensus that I got was is that it doesn't matter what we set the objective at, if we're always over it, we're not, you know, maybe the objective doesn't mean anything, but if it does, which I think it does, we need to be able to give the division or have the wildlife board or whoever give the division enough tools and opportunities to be able to get those numbers to the objective where we're over by, what was East Canyon, 300%?
Yeah.
And, you know, even Camas being over by 130, we need to get those numbers down, because I personally believe from my time being on the range that the elk are pushing the deer and hurting them in the winter. And I think if we're going to try and get our deer numbers up, we need to at least hit our objective with the elk numbers. And then I personally think that the deer will start to rebound. As I was a young boy, there were never any elk. I didn't even know what an elk looked like till I was 14. And there were deer everywhere. And as the elk have come, the deer have gone. You know, that's a simple answer to a complex problem. But I think somehow we as a committee or somehow need to encourage whoever makes the decisions to be able to give the biologists the tools that they need. And there will probably be lots of different ways that they have to deal with getting the numbers down, especially on public or on private land. But we need to be able to support whoever it is that makes that decision to give them all the tools that they need to make that happen.
And I certainly mirror your opinion. Thank as you. Far as we need to get those numbers down, especially if they're impacting the habitat, not just what they're what they need for their habitat, but the other animals on the range. So, additional comments from the council? Motions from the council? John Wall?
I make a motion that we accept the division's elk management plan as presented.
Is there a second? Craig Van Tassel? We have a motion and a second to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the elk management plans as presented. All in favor? Or discussion on the motion, I should say. Discussion? Okay. All in favor? Say aye. Please raise your hands.
Aye.
It's unanimous. And we'll have Dan Christensen with the Hardware Ranch Management Plan.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Dan Christensen. I'm the manager at Hardware Ranch with the Division of Wildlife Resources. What we're going to present to you tonight is important in a number of ways. I spent some time with some people on Hardware Ranch today that inquired as to some of the changes that are happening in conjunction with this plan. What it came to reinforce is something that I've known for the last 9 years up there, and that is people seem to have a special connection to Hardware Ranch and to what we do. And if they come up and they haven't been there, then they seek that connection. I believe that this plan facilitates that. The second part of the discussion is that we need your approval to proceed to adopt this plan. We've been working at it for a couple of years, and I'll kind of walk you through the process here. So it's good to be here tonight to finally present this plan to you. This is the comprehensive management plan. If we can get it to work. Thanks. Thank you, Jess. Okay. From the beginning, we recognized that an effort this important, it was important to share the load. We assembled at the regional level the resource managers. At any one time over the course of the last couple of years, we've had as many as 12 members of the northern region assembled as the stewardship team for this master plan. And as I say, people have a special connection, but I think it even deepened our appreciation as we looked in depth at what goes on at Hardware Ranch and what we think needs to go on at Hardware Ranch. We also, at the beginning, assembled a purposely assembled and with a lot of forethought, a group of influential people from the community who came in as a technical advisory committee. And you can just see that we included legislators, planners from the county, educators from Utah State University, a park manager from Bear Lake, who coincidentally had cooperated on two previous master planning efforts at Hardware Ranch, and then some range science people. And our message to them was pretty simple. We would like you to come and discuss what we propose, amend it, change it, suggest it, and then please take it back to your constituents, who are also our constituents, and see what they have to say about it. And I think that this effort helped us a lot. And I'll discuss some of those efforts and how they came about a little bit later. We also had a consulting firm, Logan Simpson Design, who were facilitators and helped us prepare the plan. So we had a stewardship team, the technical advisory committee, and some consultants to help us from the beginning. The purpose and structure of the management plan, we looked at this and said, okay, this is guidance for Hardware Ranch. This is how we need to do business for the next 5 years. We'll review this plan every year, and we'll amend it as necessary. But this and the standard operating procedures that you'll see mentioned in our management goals and objectives are primarily very important to us, and this is how we are doing business upon adoption. It's important to note that it also reflects Division of Wildlife missions and goals. It is important for us, all of us, to tell people that wildlife is important to the people of Utah. You know that because you're here tonight. But we tried to reflect those goals and objectives in our mission planning. We also went into a pretty comprehensive study of the history and background of Hardware Ranch, and I'll mention just a few bullets from that study. But we tried to get some context for what we were talking about. What have we done? What should we do? What can we do? Were kind of the questions we asked. And there was a formal deliverable in this, which was a public involvement plan. I actually put that in place as we started to implement some camping changes on Hardware Ranch in conjunction with this plan. And there was a communications template that I filled out there. And in the beginning, it was kind of a form check the block thing. But as you get deeper into that template in the communications plan, it causes you to step back a little bit and say, here are the resources. And among the questions it asks is, what are the consequences of not doing notification and outreach in conjunction with the efforts, the changes that are going to occur on Hardware Ranch? So that's already been put into place. We refined and redefined the mission statement, and oddly enough, we're still in the habitat and wildlife business. And we recognize that outreach is a very important component of that, and that there's a direct linkage. We established goals and objectives for Hardware Ranch, there was a lot of refinement and discussion through the course of a couple of years. And what we finally came up with is, I think, a pretty simple refinement. Each of our areas in the mission has one goal with several objectives and some implementing strategies, and I'll review those a bit. And finally, we said, what should we look like in the future in our resource areas, in our mission areas? And we defined some desired future conditions. The background, I think there was a lot of it. Some things that fell out that it's important for people to understand about Hardware Ranch and that were, again, kind of a context, is we were originally purchased with what is an open-ended federal land grant. We still operate under those auspices with some restrictions and some conditions. But we were also sort of an adjunct or an add-on to the original Millville Wildlife Management Area down on the face. And we continued that mission to keep the elk from coming in and doing depredation damage in the winter, and it just came up the canyon with us. So our original charter, the funding in that context was important. The winter feeding of elk in Cache Valley began in in Hardware Ranch in 1947, and we continue it. By the way, that fell out as a primary task and mission. If we said, what's the one thing you needed to do at Hardware Ranch, it would be continue to feed those elk. We began providing that and improving the big game habitat for the wildlife species up there at that point, and we continue with multiple projects and programs up at Hardware Ranch. And finally, another one that came out that there's no escaping that is primarily important, and it kind of ties the wildlife and habitat together. We have always had a charter and continue to have a charter to accommodate public access for wildlife-related activities. In the beginning, that was sort of hunting and fishing. We've also said it's wildlife viewing and the other activities, including camping. And so you'll see that reflected in some of the discussion. And then again, in a larger framework, it's important for people to understand, and it was important for us as a committee to realize we're one of over 100 wildlife management areas in the state of Utah, and we all share four primary objectives, and among those is the hunting and fishing, the accommodation of the public, and the hunting and fishing that carries through. So when we talk to people, we need to say, we're one of 100, we're glad you're here, we're kind of special in what we do, and I'll talk about a couple of those programs, but we're also part of a system, which is the wildlife management area system in the state. And again, just as note, we're 14,278 acres. Another important thing to remind people of is if we represent the northern region, the hundreds of square miles of the northern region as an 8x10 sheet of paper, you can just take a pencil and kind of put a dot there. And in context, that's sort of our spatial niche. But again, I think we supersede that sometimes in what we do. We identified some major issues. Obviously, the need to continue to do habitat work and that focused, and we got pretty narrow and said the primary interest is on the limited winter and transition range on Hardware Ranch for big game, as well as continuing sensitive species work. We need to improve and protect the aquatic environment up there, and luckily I'm pretty happy to report that it's largely continue a very robust and rich aquatic environment up there. We need comprehensive outreach programs for Hardware Ranch. I've worked a lot of places, but there, I've never been more in public view than on Hardware Ranch. We have a lot of people who come up and see us every day, who drive through, and they're important eyes and ears because they tell me and stop and talk, and so we discuss it. And so that community link is important. We need not only to foster that, but we need to extend that so that everybody understands what we do and feels a part of that on Hardware Ranch. So the outreach link is absolutely there and tangible. Hay production needs, you'll see this mentioned in our administration and facilities, but we need to produce the hay on Hardware Ranch to feed the elk through the winter, which is roughly 100 days, and you'll see that we need somewhere between 320 and 400 ton of hay, which we raise on 120 acres of meadow. And like everybody else, we're actively in the middle of doing that right now. And then we need well-defined recreational access management and practices, and I just tell you in big parentheses that comes through on camping, and it's a primary issue and something we discuss with the public. The mission, again, we want to foster and sustain healthy habitat and wildlife, and importantly, the outreach aspect of that is increased public awareness, stewardship of wildlife in Utah. We're lucky because we get to do that during several seasons, but also have a very rich history of that winter season where we feed the elk and have people come and get from me to you away and create memories that way. The plan broke out as healthy habitats and sustainable wildlife, public awareness and stewardship, and sort of the collective that ties it all together, the facility management and administration. So those were the primary plan and mission components. The first set that we came to was the wildlife goals and objectives, and you can see that, again, we're into healthy wildlife and habitat, and on the end of that, consideration for wildlife-oriented activities. The first objective was maintaining the winter elk feeding program. That's important not only to us, but to Utah at large, and we see a lot of out-of-town visitors. We see mostly locals and people who have a connection, but we think that we need to continue to expand that and promote the winter elk feeding, and it remains an important habitat and wildlife mission for us. We need to increase the quality of winter range, the plant communities, and we said let's keep it simple. On the DCI index that Darren just discussed for habitat evaluation, we want to take it from good to fair or bump it on up. And we are actively in the middle of looking at those existing range transects, but also in placing some photo transects to augment what we know about not only the habitat, but the range up there for improving habitat. And so we will be putting in those transects as well. And importantly, we need to reinforce and get a better handle on the baseline conditions in those areas that we intend to manipulate and try to improve on habitat. Third, reduce the habitat problems from camping and other public access by 90% over the 5 years that we've said is the life of this plan. That's a pretty tall order, and if you've been up there, you've seen some impact. Some of you have been associated with some of the changes we've tried to make, and we've done some exclosure fencing. We've done some other things, and we'll talk about how we think we can get there over the life of this plan with a 90% reduction in those impacts. Noxious weeds, we're spraying for Medusa Head Rye on Hardware Ranch tomorrow. We're actively participating with Cache County on knowing mapping, but identifying and being a little more specific with treatments. Again, number five, the existing riparian habitat. It's robust and rich. It's good. We're about to probably within the next few years fence the final mile of Rock Creek on Hardware Ranch from cattle and livestock. And that's an important thing for us to check the block on because we're pretty serious about the water quality up there as well. And then maintain the sensitive species on Hardware Ranch throughout the life of the plan. Some things we're doing, as I mentioned, in the implementation, these strategy highlights, we're raising enough hay to feed the elk through the winter, and it's going to take us 320 to 400 tons of elk of production a year to do that. We need to identify the baseline conditions we got up there, and I've mentioned that we're doing the transects and in placing the photo transects to help supplement that. We're going to continue and increase our use of GPS to enhance the GIS layering database that we have up there. That'll help us across all aspects of management. And number four, the creation of the structural improvements, the campsites. We've committed to try to do three up there, and I'll show you a little bit more about what we're talking there. Right now we're putting in campfire rings, doing some fencing along the banks of some of the waterways. Some of that's Habitat Council money that we've been able to use habitat projects to help us in this effort to delineate and control camping. A simple illustration of this is a map we prepared for a public involvement activity we conducted up in Cache Valley and have taken other places. But if you just look at the squares on the map, basically what you see is 22 squares on about 15 lineal miles along SR 101 up Blacksmith Fork Canyon, continuing up roughly the county road for another 8 miles up into Squaw Flats. With those 22 blocks, we have not 22 campfire rings, but 22 sites where we had camp trailers and vehicle access. In looking at this with two different resource evaluation teams from the stewardship team, we went up and said, okay, how could we accommodate the camping we've recognized we need to do and still protect resources? Basically, the blue is converted to a day use area. We will be enhancing and identifying sportsmen's access in those areas, but some of those areas where people were able to pull one, two, or three trailers in and be kind of crowded, especially in Blacksmith Fork Canyon, are converted to day use. The yellow represents areas that are going to be vehicle and trailer access, and we'll be delineating those as we can through the year. We've already started that process in two campground areas. And finally, the orange is day use areas, tent camping, walk-in access. So we've taken those 22 and refined them and started this plan. That brings us to facilities, goals, and objectives. This is the management aspect, and you can see it's pretty simple. We want it to be safe, functional, clean, and orderly when the public comes up. The objectives we established were to maintain the facilities and infrastructure. We are in the process of greatly developing and enhancing our standard operating procedures. They're critically important to help us do the business we need to do, plus the additional load of some of the camping and things that we've recognized in the plan. We'll maintain and improve the elk pens up there, some of you are familiar with. We continue to do some disease testing up there in the wintertime. And, of course, they've been used for a lot of other things in the past. They are also a very good thing to tell the public about because it helps us spread the word about some of the things that the division is involved with and helps us illustrate the importance of wildlife and how we work there. Number three was a surprise to me, and it was identified in our public scoping efforts, including the technical advisory committee. We need to restore food services to Hardware Ranch. How many of you have come up and eaten barbecue chicken or gone on a moonlight sleigh ride? It's a big bite, but it's a part of a history that we've got, and it's a context and something the public would like us to do. Again, we're going to do our maintenance and enhance the standard operating procedure. We have a formal WIM system, we call it, the Wildlife Inventory Management System. It's pretty comprehensive. It tracks maintenance and requirements on our equipment as well as and especially our facilities. So there's even a further commitment to that program here. The outreach component. We have a triumvirate here, and we're lucky again because we get to do it all at Hardware Ranch. We obviously need a supportive constituency. We have to tell people that it's important to maintain the wildlife and the habitat. We're lucky because we live up there in an environment where we're rich not only in the wildlife, but in habitat. And so when we can talk to the people on the sleigh rides in the wintertime or in the campsites as we do our implementation up there, it allows us to say, okay, you're in a nice, you have all the fresh air you can eat, have a nice campfire, look at the wildlife, come back and hunt and fish. You can do it with across-the-counter permits. And it allows us to reinforce the supportive constituency, the wildlife, and the habitat components. There is some history here that's important, and I use it kind of as my context when we talk to public in general. But in the 1950s, which would have been shortly, you know, I mean, we basically started in the 40s and grew in the 50s, but there were free sleigh rides up there, and they were not all that formal, but there was a lot of them going on. And they continued through the 1980s, and we hit a peak visitation of 45,000 visitors up there in 1964. Right now, over the last 9 or 10 years that we've tracked actively tracked, we've been in about the 18, 19,000 range on average, if you just take them across the mean. And that's with fee rides. The Visitor Center was funded in 1971, and that's when we began to formalize, I think, the concept and more the approach to outreach up there. The visitor operations were curtailed in 1987. It was a budgetary consideration, and consequently, from 1989 to 2003, there were concessionaires up there who helped us keep the place going. That's where we got the add-on to the Visitor Center that created the cafe. There was a all kinds of conceptual operations up there connected with snowmobile, maintenance, some availability of gas. There were actually some cabins put in up Curtis Creek that were used for hunting for a brief period of time. I mention that for a lot of reasons, but as I look as sort of a recent addition to Cache Valley, I've only been up there 25 years now. I can have coffee with the good old boys, but I still don't get to join the discussion. So that community has a context that goes back to the beginning in many ways, and they have an ownership. But when you look at some of the good old days for the more recent additions or generations up there. That was chicken in the cafe, and some other things that we've said we need to bring back. So that's the context that I developed from that. Importantly, Hardwell Ranch is one of three trailheads on the Shoshone Trail, which is a nationally recognized year-round OHV trail. That brings with us, obviously, some built-in advantages in that we have a lot of people that come up and see us for different reasons, and a lot of those people get off the sleighs in the wintertime, off their sleds, and get on our sleighs and help us that way. But the Shoshone Trail there is actively promoted by the Forest Service and by Parks and Recreation, and for good reason. And they're attended on Hardwell Ranch. We treat those people as constituents because they are constituents and they're important in our equation. And then again, to reinforce the programs, outreach programs on Hardwell Ranch, education, interpretation, communications, visitor center, and volunteer programs. We look at the approach to the conservation outreach and say, if we can bring people up and build them awareness, show them a unique environment, and in some ways, even the sleigh ride among the elk is exploration for us, for some of these guys, especially for the school kids who come up. And then maybe we can ignite the spark that says, you can be a part of this, and you can help us on Hardwell Ranch, and there's a lot of things you can do, including volunteering, but please get involved with wildlife some way, shape, or form. So that's the importance of awareness, exploration, personal involvement, and we can do that all quite easily on Hardwell Ranch. The goal then is to provide the awareness, the exploration, the inspiration to get people to buy in. Our objectives here are fairly substantial. We've said we can increase, or we need to increase, visitation, especially families, by 25% over 5 years. That's pretty heavy duty. We're going to have to work at that. I think it's achievable. It's going to cause us to look at some more partnerships and to look at maybe some advertising, which we've done before and which has been successful. I think we have a way to attain that, but I think it's also pretty ambitious. We need to improve the effective exchange of information between us and our public. And again, the barometer is, if we're going to make a change that's going to be obvious or is going to impact somebody, we need to plug in the communications template, do our homework, and get it out there so that people don't see us operating in a vacuum. And sometimes the people see us as taking. When we make these changes on camping, I've had a lot of discussions fairly recently with people who say, my family's come up here for 24 years, for generations, and we've always done this. And at that point, then we just need to step back and say, yes, and we need to preserve as opposed to restore here. So help us do that, and I'll tell you that there's been some buy-in there. So the communication, the signage, and all the stuff that goes into that, we've got to be real serious about this because we're making substantial changes. And then number three, the volunteer effort on Hardwell Ranch is absolutely critical. We have a great history of it, and you're already familiar with some changes in the dedicated hunter program that's impacting us division-wide. We've taken great advantage of that program, and it's helped us tremendously. Now it's up to us to step back and look at new ways to support the volunteer program overall, but we've been very successful in bringing people up to volunteer and coming back to Hardwell Ranch. So as we seek to promote the ranch, we also need to help bring those people on and help them feel part of the ranch in a volunteer effort. The sleigh rides and the strategies, they are the primary thing we do on Hardwell Ranch. We feed elk, and we have a unique outreach program that lets us reach publics we probably wouldn't see otherwise, and that's a jumping-off point for other ways to help our constituents understand how important our mission is. Number two, we have put a real try on improving and maintaining quality on the sleigh rides. How golden is it to have 25 minutes with people who want to come up to that environment and hear every word you've got to say? So we take that very seriously. We're striving to put everybody in uniform, to have them speak the same language as far as what we need to tell the public, and continue to be the people they are. I have drivers up there ranging in age 76 to 19. And if I had to put a finger on and say, this is my best driver, they're all pretty magic. So we're serious about that. And then recruiting and employing volunteers, particularly as we launch into a pretty ambitious effort to put camping back out there, to move from dispersed recreation, enhance our conservation of especially the riparian areas, and continue our efforts there. So that's pretty much the planning effort in a nutshell. We need you to look at this. I would mention that we have sent it to RDCC for comment. Haven't heard anything back from there. We presented it to the Habitat Council. Jim's heard this presentation a number of times. And I presented to the Cache County Council, who had a few questions. I think it was like a 35-minute presentation to them last week. We talked to their representatives after. We haven't seen anything formal, but I followed up with a visit to them, and they didn't seem to have any formal concerns.
Thank you very much, and for all the time you spent on preparing that, obviously. So,
thank you.
Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Any questions from the council on the presentation? Seeing none, we have no blue cards. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to comment on the presentation? Okay, we'll go to the council. Comments? Jim.
Well, I, as mentioned, I've heard this twice now, and I liked it both times. I appreciate what you've done, and I think we all consider Hardware Ranch to be the jewel of the WMAs in Utah, and so I just congratulate you on this program and this this new plan. And
thank you.
I move that we accept this 5-year plan for Hardware Ranch.
I'll second that, and I ditto.
Thank you very much.
We have a motion and a second to recommend the Wildlife Board adopt the Hardware Ranch Management Plan as presented. Any discussion on the motion? We'll have a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Jim, if you'd help me with the parliamentary part, we tabled the next agenda item at our last meeting. So do we need to have a motion to act on it now? Is that what you're telling me?
We do. We need to, and I'll make that motion that we bring this motion, this tabled motion, back for consideration today.
Is there a second?
I'll second. You probably don't understand.
Okay. So the hunting closure proposal by Brent Pohl, who's a landowner. I don't believe he's here. Is there anyone here representing Mr. Pohl? Okay. You should have all received a packet from Stacy with the information Mr. Pohl provided. I'd like to go ahead and act on this, since it's been on the agenda twice and we haven't had any representation from the Pohls.
It's Paul.
Paul, actually. Sorry. And I know that. I've been told that a couple times. It just...
They're sensitive about that in South Weaver.
So, you've all had a chance to read the material, I hope. So we'll go ahead and have the divisions... Yeah, we'll have Scott give the division's position on their hunting closure proposal.
Mr. Chairman, Council, last December, Brent and Lynn Pohl came into to our division, and they own 100 acres of property in South Weber. Kind of does set up by Hillfield, and And on the east or south of that property is the Daves County landfill. That'll kind of give you an idea where it's at. And they were really concerned about public safety, and so were we. We're concerned about public safety. And so I had three of the officers go over, meet with the Poles and one of the other landowners, Halen Barlow, and they looked at the property, and then we met with the Poles, Marty Bushman and Justin and I and Keith Vollenkamp, the sergeant over the south area in the northern region. And we listened to their, basically what they had to say and their proposal, which you have before you tonight. They want to close the general gun deer hunt 1 mile perimeter from Hill Air Force Base. So we've sat down, Marty and I and Justin, and we told the Poles, when we met with them at the Northern Region office that we weren't in agreement with the closure. My experience has been in working trespass cases that you're better off posting your property than you can allow people to hunt that property. And then we can place a lot of emphasis, and I offered that to the Poles, that we have one officer that lives 5 miles from their property, another officer that's 10 minutes from their property. And I said, you know, we'd be more than glad to help you to come up and work. It's a short window, 9 days, general deer season, and we'll do what we can. But anyway, in the interest of time, it's late. I'll just go through this list of why we didn't support the proposal. It appears that not all potential affected landowners have been notified of this proposal. It's not just the Paul family or Haven Barlow. There's six or seven other landowners in this same general area that would be affected. Landowners can exclude individuals from their property by properly posting the boundary close to trespass, as I mentioned just a minute ago. The division is concerned that this closure will be difficult to administer. In addition, it will be difficult to inform the public of this closure and its boundaries. I mean, 1 mile from Hillfield, you can imagine how many people that's going to impact. Closed hunting will not provide any additional protection for the landowner that is not already provided by posting the property against trespass. One thing I failed to mention in the beginning is there are a lot of deer on this property, and it's probably mentioned in their letter too that you have before you tonight, but there are a lot of deer, and I'm sure, just knowing hunters, that they're going to go into this area and hunt. And we'll do the best we can. I wish the Pauls were here tonight, and I could talk to them after, but we're going to make the offer again to go in and spend some time and see if we can help them with trespass problems. Moving on with this list. Closing private property hunting at the request of the landowner will create a precedent and invite other landowners to make similar requests. Then all the difficulties and problems associated with the single closure will be compounded manyfold across the state. A little background, municipalities have the right to address through procedure the Wildlife Board to close their cities, but the counties do not have that right under state code, and this is county property. It's their property, but it's in the county. If the division is to embark on closing hunting in all the areas of the state that are in proximity to human habitation, homes, cabins, buildings, businesses, highways, campgrounds, etc., tens of thousands of acres will be closed that will need to be described in rule or guidebooks to inform the public. And I, that's basically why we didn't support it. If we had a choice, as I mentioned, we'd post the property to no trespassing. We'd put some enforcement efforts in the area. If we close it, if they closed it to hunting, it really limits what we can do in law enforcement. If we go up there and it's posted properly and we apprehend somebody that's killed a deer, it's a lot more of a violation. Not only that, that individual can be put in for suspension for 1 year based on trespass. Where this this particular recommendation went through, we wouldn't have that made available to us. So I'd be that's basically where we're at tonight, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions if any of you members have them.
Scott isn't isn't most of that of his property in the city limits of South Weber?
You know, it's not. And a little history here real quick. It's unincorporated Davis County. And at one time, Davis County had a closure to the discharge of a firearm. And so it wasn't until of late that they changed the law, and so that's no longer available to them.
But a mile boundary around Hill Air Force Base includes South Weber, Riverdale, Clearfield, Sunset, Layton.
That's true.
And right. I don't think you can shoot a gun in any of those cities.
I'd have to check. Most of the towns that you mentioned in Davis County are closed.
Right.
To the discharge of a firearm and or to hunting. So.
Jim, he does own private property in South Weber and also in the unincorporated area. So his proposal that he provided in writing, though, was a one-mile boundary. It says 1 mile, all locations within 1 mile of Hill Air Force Base, which is exactly what you're describing.
Right.
So we'll just go through our standard procedure. Are there any questions from the public on this proposal? Seeing none. Questions from the council? Are there any comments from the public on this proposal? And none? Okay, we'll go back to the council. Comments from the council on the proposal? Ann?
I propose to accept the recommendation that to accept the recommendation as presented.
Well, no.
By the division to recommend to the Wildlife Board. It's late.
to not take action.
You're recommending that we reject the proposal from the Paul family.
Yes, and we accept their recommendations, the division's recommendations.
Right.
Okay, we have a motion from Ann
to
reject the hunting closure proposal from, recommend the Wildlife Board reject the hunting closure proposal from the Pauls and adopt I don't know if we need to adopt the division's presentation. It would just be reject the hunting closure from the Paul family.
I'll second.
Third.
We have a second from Jim. Discussion on the motion.
I'd just like to say that I have property with lots of deer on it also, and I have people that are shooting down through my cows trying to get a deer early in the morning or late at night with a spotlight. And I think the trespass issue is the easiest way and the best way to deal with that. So I agree wholeheartedly.
And I, too, respect, you know, most of our philosophy in Utah and the West is that private property is the landowner's property to manage how they want and their responsibility. And I really feel that they need to post it and try to enforce that. And with the additional help from the division is going to be the best way to manage that. So any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Justin has a couple words, and then we'll adjourn.
Yeah, you each should have received one of these commemorative coins from the Division of Wildlife, and it's just kind of a small token of our appreciation for all your service here on the council, so I hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn.
Solid gold.
Thank you very much.
That's where all attached.